Howdy, everybody, and welcome to week number 3 of May of the Dead. Of the Dead. I'm Uncle Bill.
And I'm a creepy Kentuckian, if you will. How's everybody doing out there? Where the hell's Jess at?
She's not going to be here today. She had anal flossing she had to attend to. Got to get up in there every now and then.
I always wondered this. I maybe should ask her when she's here. She'll be here for the mailbag, though, a little bit later.
Should be,
on,
yeah.
Exclusively. It's like, well, I guess she doesn't even, she ain't at that point yet, though, when you're pregnant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, say you're 7-8 months pregnant, and you have to go shit. Are you, like, concerned, like, oh, I don't know, that the baby might actually come out or something?
Well, babies don't come from your ass.
Yeah, but it's down that same area. It's the in the general parameter or whatever.
It's in the general perimeters of the vag. And
yeah.
Well, I guess that's true. I don't know if she has that fear. We'll definitely have to ask her later, though. But I know that I know some women actually have fucking gone to take a shit, not known that they were pregnant for 9 months, and actually, like, had the baby on the toilet.
Interesting.
I don't know how it is you would not know you're pregnant for 9 fucking months. Because I know she's pregnant all the time because she's, like, fucking moody as all hell.
Well, that was probably, that's her, though. That's not the, she's always been kind of like that.
Oh, God, I don't know. It's gotten, like, 1,000 times worse. Children and young people out there, let me give you some advice. Don't ever do that. Don't ever get anybody pregnant. Because, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. Your woman will change. She will become a demon of some sort.
I think she's just using that as an excuse to act like that.
I don't think so. I don't think that's it.
Anyway, though, May of the Dead this week is a groundbreaking show. Because here in a few minutes, we're going to have Stuart Gordon, the director, reanimator, Castle Freak. Well, he's done all kinds of stuff. He's writer of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. We talk about that.
Yeah, unless
we talk
we
about
forget
Dolls.
From Beyond and yeah. You know, Dolls and fucking all the Masters of Horror episodes that he did.
He did 2 Masters of Horror.
Including my favorite one, probably, of the whole series, which was the Black Cat one with...
Yeah. I think he was the only guy, or maybe there was one or two others, maybe Mick Garris was another one, that did both seasons of Masters of Horror and did The Fear Itself, which was the spinoff.
Okay. Hey, I want to be honest about this, too. There are very few people left that I really get excited about when it comes to like the possibility of doing an interview with him. And you can attest to this, too. Like, he was definitely one of those guys. Like, I really wanted to talk with this guy because he's one of the few living legend director guys that we have not interviewed on this show. I mean, we've interviewed Carpenter and Romero and Dante and just all the guys that were the huge guys, except for, I guess, Craven at this point.
And Hooper.
We might as well never even worry about that.
Well, you're always going to get people asking for them, and that's the thing, like... I mean, I'm sure if the right connection came along, we could get Wes Craven. But, like, I don't think Toby Hooper would ever fucking do it.
I don't either.
I mean, that's one guy, like, I'll just say, like, unless we met him at a convention and got him to do a brief little interview or something, that'd be the only way we would ever get to talk to him. Which sucks because, you know, the Texas Chainsaw thing and then the whole Poltergeist fiasco. I would love to ask him about that sort of thing, but what are you going to do? I mean, you can't make these people talk to you. I don't, unfortunately, I'd like to, but.
No. Yeah. But, I mean, this is one of those guys that everybody wants to hear from. Everybody's been asking us about this interview for a long, long time. We finally got to do it, and I was really thankful that we got to do it, too. And actually, we've had, like, a string of really good interviews here lately, I think. The McLaughlin interview was great, and the Frumkes interview I thought was really, really good, too.
Yeah, and, you know, the whole May of the Dead thing, I mean, we try to do this every year, and, you know, we were We had the long fucking, like, it was like over 90 minute McLaughlin interview,
mm-hmm.
right? And we were thinking, oh hell, we'll have at least two parts with Stuart Gordon. But it just didn't work like that. I mean, we weren't rushed or anything. We had all the time we needed, but it just, you know, it was one of those deals where it was a brief interview. It wasn't, it was brief for us. It was like 30 some odd minutes.
Right.
So, I mean, we'll be talking a little bit about what we're going to do for the finale of May of the Dead. I have no idea. But there's some ideas.
I don't think we can top that, really.
Probably not, interview-wise, so we may think of something else to do. I don't know. But, yeah, the Stuart Gordon thing, I know everybody's going to really like it. And, you know, we talk about, towards the end there, about the state of the genre itself, too. I mean, that's something I always try to bring into the interview, and I'm sure that you guys will appreciate that. But the last week, a lot of people seemed to really be liking the Friday the 13th show that we did, and it was covered on the Friday the 13th franchise website as well, which was cool.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and a lot of people seemed to really dig it. But, I mean, May of the Dead is something like, looking back, like I was thinking about last week, that we have done off and on since like 2006, I think was the mm-hmm. first year we did it. And then like, we were really blowing our loads the first couple of years in the May of the Dead because we didn't have hardly any of these people interviewed. So we had so many people that we could get. And the last couple of years, like I think we brought it back last year for the first time in a couple of years. And, it was just so fucking hard to find people that we haven't talked to.
Mm-hmm. I didn't think this time was that hard, really. It was just, to find people. It's just, you gotta want to find quality interviews from people you haven't really talked to before. And that's what's getting hard at this point is because we've talked to damn near everybody you can talk to, really. The only thing I wanted to do that I don't think now that will ever happen, we would just it would have to be some sort of fluke or somebody would have to know somebody and they would have to get us in touch with them at a show because otherwise I don't think it's going to happen, is to interview anybody from the main cast of Dawn of the Dead. I mean, I've tried to do that every year and have never been successful getting any of those people to agree to an interview.
Well, I mean, those people, aside from Ken Forey, they rarely even do conventions, do they? I mean, David Emge, you'll see him occasionally, but the other two.
No, not really.
They really, you don't see them do shows. And, you know, whatever. I mean, there's always going to be people that you'd like to get that are sort of, you know, like Jamie Lee Curtis. I'd love to talk to her, but, I mean, that's just not going to happen. Unless
you can give her some Activia and make her shit or something.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Come on, Jamie Lee, I got a cup of Activia.
But, yeah, I mean, we don't do the interviews as much as we used to. But there's a good reason behind that. I mean, you know, as far as time issues, we don't have a lot of time to get the interviews. And we fucking interviewed, God, I don't know how many fuckers that we've had.
I think we've really interviewed, like if you look back on the other May of the Dead shows, we've interviewed most of the main cast of Day of the Dead. And I think, as a matter of fact, quite a bit of the main cast of Day of the Dead. Almost anybody you can think of, too, from like, we interviewed some people from Nigh Living Dead. Return of the Living Dead. There's really not any big dead film aside from, and even Dawn of the Dead, we interviewed Savini, so, and Romero. So there's not any big dead film that we haven't done at least one interview from.
We interviewed David Early and Mike Christopher, too. Yeah. You forgot about that. That was like a double whammy. So, yeah. Interviews, yeah, as far as next week, probably not. We'll think of something creative to do, though, because, you know, it's one of those deals where, hey, we're like, oh, yeah, we can definitely have Stuart Gordon. We'll talk to him all day. He's just one of those guys. It was a great interview, but it just, you know, we talked all that we said all we needed to say in, like, you know, 40 minutes.
Yeah, and he was a super nice guy, though, too, and I kind of thought he would be just based on, you know, his past experiences and interviews and things like that.
Yeah.
And he used to be a hippie at one time. And we seem to get along with hippies pretty well.
You do.
Former hippies.
So anyway, the Stuart Gordon thing is a little bit later on, and we do have news to get to as well, and we do have reviews.
And what we're going to do is we're going to actually review an oldie but a goodie on, in the new form of Blu-ray, which is Short Circuit 2. Not Short Circuit now. Not the original. This is the one where he's in New York. This is Short Circuit 2.
This is Short Circuit 2 from Image Entertainment. That I was surprised, actually, that they came out with that soon. I mean, the thing is about some companies, like Image and Echo Bridge and stuff like that, they'll release these movies that you're like, who the hell would want that on Blu-ray? You know, like Ernest. They've got the Ernest movies on Blu-ray.
I don't think anybody was like scrambling to get the Blu-ray of Short Circuit 2.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's a big, like, you know, question mark for even Short Circuit 1 on Blu-ray. Really, I mean, it was okay.
Yeah.
It was okay hit, I guess. But you've got movies like that that's coming out before fucking Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jaws and movies like that.
Short Circuit 2, buy it!
I love Short Circuit 2, though. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And Black Swan, Uncle Bill. We talked about it. We did an on-the-road review for it. I'm looking forward to talking about it again. I watched the majority of it again. I watch all of it, but you know, we just watched it like originally a couple months ago.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about that a little bit later on.
We might as well though throw it in as like a extra bonus interview because we don't do a lot of wrestling stuff on here, and just mention the Wrestling Road Diaries, which is on DVD, which we'll also try to review that too.
Yeah, I know I got that here somewhere. So anyway, you might as well, we've been talking at it here for 12 fucking minutes, talk about some of the news topics of the week. Not a whole lot of stuff going on, but, we'll, mention what we got. John Carpenter's The Ward, which is a movie that we've been talking about for at least 2 years on here, is going to be made available video on demand on June 8th. A theatrical debut is planned for July 8th, which I've just given up on trying to make sense of it, out of how that makes any sense at all. The film is a psychological thriller about a young woman locked in a mysterious mental institution in the 1960s. It's John Carpenter's first feature film in over 10 years. Kristen, played by Amber Heard, is a beautiful but troubled young woman who finds herself bruised, cut, drugged, and held against her will, baby, in a remote ward of psychiatric hospital. She's completely disoriented and has no idea why she was brought to this place, has no memory of her life before being admitted. All she knows is she ain't safe, buddy. She's fucked in the ward.
I think about Sting when I think about this movie, because the only thing that's for sure is that nothing is for sure, meaning that the last couple of movies that John Carpenter made were shit. Let's be honest. But the guy made, like, legendary fucking movies in the past, so you know he's got it in him. I just don't have any faith in older directors making modern movies. I really don't.
Well, one thing that you might want to consider, though, is John Carpenter hasn't made an independent film in a long time. And this isn't a big budget studio movie. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it'll probably suck, but there's always a slim chance it might be worth a shit.
I've heard some people talk about seeing parts of this movie, I think, like reviewers and stuff. But I don't think that, I don't think the reviews were that positive.
Yeah, we'll see it real soon.
Oh God, here's one I hope we never ever get a fucking chance to see. Although I know we would end up watching it, is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D.
Oh, no.
New Image is at the Cannes Film Festival promoting a number of titles, including, of course, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D. And let's see. The film is on track for a summer 2012 release. John Lusenhop will direct the film this summer for Lionsgate Entertainment. Holy shit. John Lusenhop's on the front burner for this bitch.
Yeah. It sounds like to me, though, that it's probably going to be just a completely revamped, like they're not going to really try to connect it, and that's probably a good move to the remake and the prequel to the remake.
It's going to be a reimagining of a remake.
We can just hope Andrew Bernarski's retarded ass is in it.
Because he's the best fucking Leatherface ever.
Best Leatherface ever.
I will say he's probably the Leatherface that uses the most amount of crack cocaine.
You know, I just think, like, we were talking about the Fright Night remake, too, which is also in 3D.
Wow, yeah. We saw that's the big news going around the web this past week is the trailer for Fright Night remake.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say about that. I mean, it just, like, the 3D trend, though, is like, I think it's already fizzling out a little bit. There's just, like, every goddamn movie doesn't have to be in 3D.
No, and that's the thing. They're really ruining the format by putting movies that don't really need to be in 3D in 3D, like fucking Saw and this. It's like, you want something that will actually you want something that'll maximize the 3D potential, not just something to be putting fucking shit in 3D about.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I'll even say, hey, some parts of Texas Chainsaw Massacre might be effective in 3D, but there's movies like fucking, like, the Fright Night. What in the fuck can they do at Fright Night, on the Fright Night remake that would make it work?
Well, see, what they'll do, like, I can just envision in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D, there'll be at least one scene, you mark my fucking words, where Leatherface chops something off of somebody, and it goes flying through the air at you in the fucking screen.
Oh.
And I don't know what they'll do. I'm betting in the Fright Night thing, they'll have at least one scene where Colin Farrell, or Colin Farrell, as I like to call him, turns into a bat and flies out the fucking screen at you.
Yeah, I am.
It's a homosexual bat. Everybody get down.
Yeah, whatever. Well, you know the sad thing is, though, Fright Night will probably make a fuck ton of money, too. That's usually the trend. Like, usually the movies that look the worst make the most money.
The ones that look slick and over-stylized and have, like, a lot of production values always make a ton more money.
It's like that shitty fucking Prom Night remake that came out. That damn thing made a fortune. That was one of the worst movies ever.
It was.
So, anyway, Severin Films got this other one last news topic, then we'll take a break, has marked June 28th as the day to give Bloody Birthday, Nightmares, and The Baby their DVD debut. Now, Bloody Birthday will come with a 50-minute interview with director Ed Hunt and a featurette with Lori Lethen and a brief history of slasher films featurette. Now, Bloody Birthday is actually a really fucking good horror movie that not a lot of people know about, but it has actually been on DVD before.
Yeah, because we both got the damn DVD.
Yeah, that's what I was confused about. And I'm thinking Nightmares fits the same anthology. Or maybe it could be another movie.
I've seen the cover. I don't think it's the same movie.
But there's another anthology movie called Nightmares that's already been on DVD, too. Bloody Birthday, though, like, I highly recommend anybody to go and check that out if you're into, like, killer kid movies.
It'd be funnier
like
than hell, though, if it was a different Bloody Birthday. There's two movies called Bloody Birthday.
For some reason, I doubt that, though.
But, you know, my favorite part of this story is that the baby is going to be out on DVD. Yeah, woo, the baby.
I don't know what the baby is, baby. But I've been watching that on DVD, too. So, anyway, we should take a break, though, don't you think? And then we'll get back to some more horror news.
Let's break it down.
Ooh, here on DeadPip.com. You know what, Uncle Bill?
Shut your fucking mouth right now.
No. I want to talk about Fast Custom Shirts.
Holy shit. Well, let's talk about it.
FastCustomShirts.com provides some of the best horror t-shirts I have ever fucking seen.
I don't think that you can really fully appreciate how awesome the t-shirts are over at FastCustomShirts.com until you go over to FastCustomShirts.com and look for yourself.
Yeah. The Hitman T-Shirt Joe.
Mm-hmm.
The highest quality of shirts that I've actually designed some of, Uncle Bill. He actually lets the fans design some of the shirts for his site. Who else does that? Who else?
Nobody I know of. But when he's not busy playing with Carmen Obsey, he's busy cranking out some of the most high-quality fucking shirts that you're going to find this side of any other damn whore t-shirt maker.
Yeah. So check him out. FastCustomShirts.com. The best there is.
The best there was.
And the best there ever will be.
It's a boot respect. Welcome back, bitches.
Hi.
Now let's get on with the news portion of the programming,
shall we? Left do this shit.
We're going to be talking about Rob Zombie.
Yeah!
Holy Lord, and it looks like we've got a really detailed plot synopsis here for Lords of Salem, which is Rob Zombie's latest project. And it says, the plot has been relegated to a few sentences that was teased by a radio DJ and a cursed record and a bunch of witches terrorizing Salem, Massachusetts. But now there's more to this, though. It says, Heidi, a blonde rock chick, DJs at a local radio station, and together with the two Hermans, Whitey and Munster, oh my God, forms part of the Big H radio team. A mysterious wooden box containing a vinyl record arrives for Heidi, and a gift of the Lord. She assumes it's a rock band on a mission to spread their word. As Heidi and Whitey play the Lord's record, it starts to play backwards, and Heidi experiences a flashback to a past trauma. Later, Whitey plays the Lord's record, dubbing them the Lords of Salem, and to his surprise, the record plays normally and is a massive hit with his listeners. The arrival of another wooden box from the Lords presents the Big H team with free tickets, posters, and records to a host gig in Salem. Soon, Heidi and her cohorts, Heidi and her cohorts are far from the rock spectacle they're expecting, and the original Lords of Salem are returning, and they're out for blood.
Ooh.
That movie sounds exactly like something out of the 80s, though. It sounds like something like would be Trick or Treat or something like that.
I love the fact, though, that he has a guy that's going to be called Munster Herman.
And Whitey. You got Heidi and Whitey. But he's a fucking genius at writing. Everybody thinks that.
Heidi and Whitey, yeah!
What? Oh, God. Okay, if you like Rob Zombie, I understand. I feel bad for you, but I understand. But seriously, you have to admit, and everybody has to admit, that guy's a horrible writer. You may like his movies visually, but the dialogue in all his movies and the characters and everything he creates is fucking ridiculous.
But I don't know. I like the Hermans, Whitey and Munster.
I know you're a big fan of them.
That's just hilarious. Like, he really thought, we're going to call him Munster Herman, yeah!
Oh, God.
Scorpion releasing, a.k.a. Code Red DVD, for those that don't know. This is they call it Scorpion releasing, but it's a subdivision of Code Red. So you can take this for what it's worth. Catriona's Nightmare Theater is a new line of DVDs they're going to be releasing, hosted by actress and former WWE and now TNA star Katarina Lee Waters, who you may remember as Katie Lee Burchill.
Ooh.
Now she's known as Winter on TNA, or I'm sorry, Impact Wrestling is what they're called now. I wonder what it'll be called next year. They'll change the name of it again because it's still going to suck. She introduces a series of cult films, many of them for the very first time on DVD. Katarina will introduce such horror classics as The House on Sorority Row, Final Exam, The Incubus, Humongous, which is one that a lot of people have been asking for years.
It was a guy that directed Prom Night. Paul Lynch, somebody like that, yeah.
The Carpenter, which stars Wings Hauser, The Human Experiments, American Nightmare with Michael Ironside. There's a lot of movies called American Nightmare, too. The Devil Within Her, starring Joan Collins. The Twin Terrors of the Mark of Cain. And Nothing But Night, which stars Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. Each DVD will have a play with or without Catriona's intro and closing segments, and some will have audio commentaries with filmmakers moderated by Katarina. All the DVD sleeves will feature a reversible cover. The first wave will be released in September, just in time for Halloween, and new DVDs coming out each month through March of next year.
That's neat. So, although we're never going to see them unless we pay for them.
I don't even know here, like, I don't want to say, I've heard a few things about the people that release. I'll just say this. I wouldn't hold my breath for some of these titles to come out. Yeah. I mean, we've heard shit for years about, oh shit, we're going to come out with a Mutilator. It never fucking come out.
What's the other big one too?
I mean, there was a bunch of them.
Nightmares and Damaged Brain.
Yeah, that's never come out.
Yeah. As far as us getting these movies, though, I think I got a better chance to get my dick sucked by a porcupine than we do getting any of these movies.
Well, you got a pet porcupine that likes to suck dick, especially the small ones.
We call it Spocky Joker.
Yeah. So, all you guys, hey, these may very well, they might come out. I think that the whole Elvira ripoff thing is stupid, though. Nobody knows who she is. Nobody gives a fuck.
Who? Kaylee Burchill?
Katarina. Well, they should have. Well, they can't say Kaylee Burchill, I don't guess, because WWE owns that shit. But, I mean, nobody knows who she is. I don't even know if she knows what the hell she's talking about when it comes to these movies. Probably not.
Are you ready?
Yeah!
Let's talk about one movie that I'm sure will actually be coming out, though. Dark Knight of the Scarecrow on Blu-ray.
On Blu-ray disc.
It says, if you picked up a recent issue of Whorehound number 29, and everybody should have, then you know that VCI is prepping the 30th anniversary edition of Dark Knight of Scarecrow for Blu-ray.
Blu-ray disc.
The transfer will be 1080p, 24 FPS, progressive transfer, and may contain all new extras.
Ooh.
So buy that shit immediately when it comes out.
I will definitely buy that, because we got the screener copy, which is fucked up anyway. And they just did a really good job with that. I mean, I don't have a problem buying that. Mention-wise, this weekend we have the Cult Fiction Drive-In, Uncle Bill, in Jacksonville, Florida. Guests include Sid Haig and Pam Grier together for has to be the first time at a convention. I don't even remember doing a convention before.
You can finally get all of your Jackie Brown stuff signed.
Lynn Lowry is going to be there.
He's going to be there staring around looking... Mousy.
Pretty.
You get the feeling Lynn Lowry, like, took way too many hits of acid back in the day or something. What do you think?
Oh, I like wood. Like, these lights are pretty around here. This place tastes like rainbows.
You know she's fucked up.
Yeah. They're also having, I know Critter fans actually making the trip all the way down there for the Critters reunion. Uncle Bill.
Well, who's going to be in the Critters Reunion?
Well, I can only remember D. Wallace. I don't know the other fuckers' names that were in it. I think there's like three people that are going to be there.
Hell yeah!
So, Critter fans all excited.
You know Larry Bishop's going to be there too, yeah. Right? Everybody's looking forward to that.
Larry Bishop's going to be there. Gary Clark's going to be there. It's actually like I really like how they've done, how they put together that show. You can go to cultfictiondrivein.com for more info, and they got more guests and stuff on there too.
So let's talk about DVDs and Blu-rays then. For May the 24th, you got
a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot. You got the Platoon 2-disc Blu-ray and DVD combo. You have Fertile Ground, which is an After Dark original, and Seconds Apart, which is an After Dark original, which we got both of those, but I'm going to try very hard not to watch either one of them. Also, and this is the one that's been blowing everybody's mind, Gnomeo and Juliet on Blu-ray.
I know for a fact I'm definitely going to get the Blu-ray of that.
Fucking Gnomeo and Juliet. What are you going to do about that?
You know, that reminded me, though. And it's weird. I don't know if it's just in conjunction with that. The one-year anniversary of Dio passing away was actually this week.
Why the hell did Gnomeo and Juliet remind you of Dio?
Don't you remember the story about the garden gnome that...
Where it took his finger?
Yeah, it took
part of his thumb or something.
One of his thumbs off or something like that.
Yeah, that is kind of sad, though. I miss
that. That was always
a new
joke, though, with us and a good friend of ours that was a big Dio supporter.
You really look back on his music, though. His music should have been, like, entitled Inspirational Metal or something like that, because all of his songs are about, like, overcoming something and, like, well, there's a lot of fairies and dragons and shit mixed in there with it, but it's, like, it's always about, like...
It's fairy metal.
Yeah. Fairy metal.
That's the thing. Like, the thing is... that's, to me, separates metal from then as opposed to now is metal back then, whether it was hair metal or whatever it was, the majority of the bands back then was all about just music and having fun and, you know, everybody partying and stuff like that. And now it's just about burning churches and, like, fucking raping sheep and stuff, whatever else. Like, what the hell? They talk, a school full of murder. Just a bunch of shit. Like,
well, that's just like death metal and European metal, though. Like, they really don't make metal like you're talking about anymore. Like,
I know, but
metal.
What, like, the whole Dio, man, like, even though a lot of people considered his music, some of it may have been a little bit satanic or something like that. You know,
not
that's
really.
Always, yeah, but that's always the thing that people say.
Like, if you ever think Dio's music
but
is
look,
fucking satanic.
You listen to Dio, though, or watch his videos and stuff. He never fucking took himself completely seriously when it comes to that.
And then I beg you, though, like, listen to Dio's music and then go and listen to one of those fucking, like, Norwegian black metal bands. Like, I don't
well, I'm
know,
just
like,
saying that was the stigma, though. Like,
ass eradicator or something like that.
The, you know, they would say that he was more on the satanic side of things or something. Even though he wasn't. I mean, Judas Priest is the same fucking way.
They thought everybody was satanic.
Yeah.
Man, I think.
But, like, these motherfuckers that are out now, I don't even know if they're really satanic or not, but they push the Satan thing. Like, to me,
it's a gimmick,
though. It is. It's a stupid gimmick. Like, who gives a fuck? Like, I don't want to know anything about anybody's religion when it comes to music. You can either play music, you fucking can't. That's the way I look at it.
You just tell
you can sing or you go. To me, there's no like or dislike about that. That's not fucking music. That's my opinion.
Right now, somewhere in Florida, well, Adam Beck's like, fuck you!
We're pissing a bunch of people off. That's my damn opinion. I love pissing people off anyway. That's how I roll.
No, seriously, though. I've heard people try to defend and argue about, like, death metal vocalists and stuff. No. I'm sorry, but no. That's not really any kind of, like,
but
talent.
I don't even know the label, you know, whatever you put on. If it's death metal, I just, you know, the Cookie Monster vocals, I guess, is what. Anything like that, I can't get into that. And the music side of it is shit, too.
You know how you know if a singer is not talented? If you can't understand a goddamn word that they're saying, or if there's no melody of anything that they're saying, then that's how you know that they ain't worth a shit.
Yeah.
Because even with Lemmy, I can make out one out of every three words he's saying. With those fucking guys, they could be singing a fucking cookbook and I wouldn't know. They could be like, fucking margarine, tablespoon, half a cup of margarine, half a cup of milk. See, that'd be an awesome
there you
song.
Go.
So, call anyway. That one a half a cup of flour.
Yeah, definitely, though, raise your metal horns for Dio, your devil metal horns, whatever you want to call it.
The interesting thing about Dio, since you brought it up, though, according to like, his vocal style, I don't think he was as powerful as, like, Halford. He could not hit the same like notes as Halford, but I don't think anybody really could that was like singing metal at that time. But his medium range vocals, like his regular singing voice, was probably the best of any of those guys that sang metal at that time.
Well, I think that he was a guy, and we got to see him one time in concert, that he's a small guy. I mean, he's, you know how short he is. He's like he was 5 foot tall, something like that.
Yeah.
But he had like a stage presence that nobody else up, I don't know if you remember that, that nobody else up on that stage could even, and I think that's what got people so much into him, because he didn't, like, you know, you got fucking, a lot of these guys, like, Mick Jagger that dances around on stage and does everything else to have some sort of stage presence, you know, he fucking controlled the entire audience with his damn voice. I don't know if I've ever seen anybody else that has really done that. I mean, he just stood up there on the stage and, you know, threw out the devil horns every once in a while. That was it. That was all he needed to do. And like,
fucking Bruce Dickinson, though, he was too busy bitching about security to do anything else.
Yeah.
That's like, bullshit!
I've always said that, though, even though, you know, even before Dio passed away, that was, he was the best of the night. Like, he did the best job.
Yeah, he was. So a big salute to him on the 1 year anniversary of his death. That really friggin' sucks, though.
Yeah. Because, like, all these guys, all of our favorite musicians are slowly but surely, I mean, they're dying off.
I'm just waiting for Angus to die. Because you know it's coming.
Yeah. And then he looks kind of rough lately anyway.
That's going to be the end of it. I'm going to quit listening to music.
I've pretty much quit listening to it anyway. I mean, I listen to stuff every once in a while. But anyway, we've rambled on enough. Let's go to the interview, of course, with the director, writer, reanimator, Stuart Gordon, by God. Here on DeathBeard.com. Tell us about how you first shown an interest in films and what were the movies that really inspired you to make a career out of movies.
Well, I started making movies when I was a teenager. You know, with a little it wasn't even a Super 8 camera back then, just an 8mm camera, with my friends. So I've always wanted to make films. The first movie I ever saw was The Greatest Show on Earth, Cecil B. DeMille's circus movie. And I think Spielberg said that was the movie that got him started, too. Although, for me, it made me want to become a clown.
Now, I understand that you did a lot of, was it plays in the 60s? And one in particular where something about you had gotten arrested?
I got arrested for it. My wife and I did, actually. It was Peter Pan, believe it or not.
Well, it seems like an odd play to be arrested for some reason.
I know. That's what I thought at the time. But it was sort of a psychedelic adaptation of it. And in order to fly, they dropped LSD. and we had a sequence in which we had 7 naked dancers, with a light show projected on them. And that was the scene that got us arrested.
Well, I mean, it was the 60s, though. I mean, that doesn't sound too out there for that time. I mean...
Well, it was, it was also, we were making a political statement, and I think that kind of pissed people off, too. Mm-hmm. So, they came down, and it was pretty hard.
Now, at the time, did you go to film school, per se, or did you,
No, I never went to film school. Which is funny, because I sometimes teach at film schools. I wanted to take a film class, this was back in the late 60s, and there was only one class in those days, and it was full, so I couldn't get in. And I ended up taking an acting class and fell in love with theater. And directed theater for the next 15 years.
Now, when did the interest in the H.P. Lovecraft stuff come about? I mean, were you a fan for a long time since you were a kid, or was it something that you caught on to later?
I started reading him when I was a teenager, and his stuff is just so weird and scary, and I really liked him from the beginning.
Now, I guess, was Reanimator the first film you had made, or did you make films before that, leading up to that?
It was the first feature that I made. Before that, I had, I directed an adaptation of one of the plays we did at the theater company, which was a play called Bleacher Bums, about the Chicago Cubs fans, and did that for PBS. So that was, I did some television work, but Reanimator was the first feature.
Now, at that time, I've always been confused about, I think Charles Band helped produce the film, is that right?
Well, Charlie Band distributed the movie, his company, Empire Pictures, distributed the film. And he did get involved as with the production of it. Provided, part of the deal was in exchange for providing post-production services, he was able to distribute the movie. So, all of the editing and the sound work and, was part of the deal. But he got very interested in the movie. He liked what he was seeing with the dailies, and he, let us use his effects people. John Beekler joined the group, and he got us Mac Allberg, his director of photography. He brought him on board, so he did have an impact on the production.
Now, as far as Reanimator goes, the original cast, the first film, Bruce Abbott, Jeffrey Combs, and Barbara Crampton, is just amazing ensemble cast. There, were they all auditioned at the time? And I know Jeffrey Combs had to be really young, particularly.
Yeah, they were all very young. I mean, yeah. They were all in their mid-20s, I think. But yeah, they all auditioned.
Had you ever met Combs before that? I mean, were you familiar with anything that he did?
No. It was actually our casting director who had seen him in a play and thought that he would be, you know, could make a really good Herbert West. And he was absolutely right. He brought him in, and as soon as I saw him, I said, this is the guy.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine anybody else playing that role now.
No, it's funny because, you know, Lovecraft describes Herbert West looking very different than Jeffrey Combs. You know, in Lovecraft's story, Herbert West is like a blonde. You know, they call him a towhead, actually. So, you know, Jeffrey, of course, has got dark hair, but his attitude is so much like Herbert West. I mean, he really captured that kind of single-mindedness, you know, kind of, you know, he's a fanatic and doesn't care about anything except, you know, his reagent and perfecting it.
Hmm.
So, you know, human life is kind of like, you know, who cares?
Yeah. It seems so weird because the movie is really unlike anything else that was coming out around that time. I mean, there's a lot of dark comedy in it. There's a lot of gore in it. Of course, there was some of that around the mid-80s and stuff, too. But, I mean, what was the inspiration behind making a movie in that style?
Well, it started because around those in those days, and it's sort of like what's going on now, everybody was making all these vampire movies. And I was getting kind of tired of them. I said to somebody, I wish somebody would make a Frankenstein movie because I always loved Frankenstein. And they suggested that I read Herbert West Reanimator by H.P. Lovecraft, which I'd never heard of. I'd read Lovecraft, but I'd never heard of that story. And, you know, just when I finally got a copy of it, it was like, wow, this would make a great movie. So I think it was it's a mad scientist movie, which was a, you know, kind of a subgenre that had sort of fallen out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the movie had really great over-the-top makeup effect sequences, and this was long before the day of, you know, CGI, and that seems to be a lot of what we see nowadays. How tedious was that stuff to shoot on a daily basis because there was just so much of it in Reanimator?
Well, it was, there was a lot of it. And, you know, we had a really great crew, you know, dealing with all of it. You know, the makeup effects actually were based on visits that I had made to the morgues in both Chicago and Los Angeles. And, photographs that I, you know, was given by the pathologist there, and so we were trying to make the corpses look as realistic as we possibly could.
Mm.
And you know, they even had to use you know, spray guns on the actors' bodies to get the, you know, there's all this stuff that it's called lividity, which is when the blood settles when someone is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So their skin, you know, where their, you know, the backs of where they've been lying turns kind of purplish, and mm-hmm. So they were, you know, spraying the actors are all naked in this movie, too, all of the corpses. So they had all this body paint on them.
Hmm.
You know, very elaborate. And, you know, to get, you know, it was a low-budget movie, and we had to move really quickly, but they were able to kind of, you know, get these guys done and in front of the cameras very, very quickly, which was great.
Hmm.
You know, so it was a terrific crew. And, you know, I think we used something like 30 gallons of blood in that movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
So all I remember is my feet sticking to the floor all the time.
And I'm sure that another thing, though, that gets asked a lot of you, too, is, and probably the most memorable sequence in the film is the gag with, you know, David Gale and Barbara Crampton with the head in the tray and all that. And
yep.
I don't even know where to begin about questions with that, really.
I had heard that.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, that's the best I can come up with.
Well, it was, you know, one of the ideas we had was that when the corpses are reanimated, it sort of frees their libidos. You know, these guys are not polite any longer. And you know, here's this guy who's obsessing on this beautiful girl, and so when he becomes, you know, a reanimated corpse, you know, it's like he wants her. Now the problem is that he's been beheaded, so what's he going to do? How's he going to, you know, make love to this girl? And that was the question that was kind of posed. And in the middle of the night, I got a call from one of the writers, Dennis Paoli, who was laughing so hard he could hardly talk, and he said, I think I've just come up with the first visual pun.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs>
Well, I think the scene is actually referenced in a few movies, but in particular, like I remember, I think American Beauty, which is like an Academy nominated, they actually referenced that scene in that film,
too. Yeah, I was amazed by that. A friend, actually, it was Jeffrey Combs called me up after he saw the movie. He said, "You got to go see this film." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "I can't tell you. You just got to go."
Now, I know that the movie was released unrated, but was that always the plan, or were you guys just doing whatever?
No, I mean, we were hoping to get an R rating on the film, but it was just so extreme that they, you know, I mean, it was kind of like, what were we thinking, you know, when I look back at it all. But I have to say that I was really, you know, still kind of in awe that Charlie Band and Empire Pictures decided to release the movie unrated rather than trying to hack it up and, you know, cut out all of the good stuff. So, you know, I have to say, you know, bravo to those guys for having, you know, the cojones to do that.
I don't know. I mean, we've had Charles Band on the show and stuff. He seems like he would take like a Roger Corman-esque approach to filmmaking. I don't know what it was like to work with him, but that's just the way he seems to me.
Well, yeah, except Corman, I don't think has ever released an unrated movie.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah.
You know, I think it was really gutsy on Charlie's part to do that. And, the movie was a success in spite of that, you know, which kind of proves that you don't have to have a rating.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know if you think this, I think it was probably more successful because, in a cult way over the years and stuff too, because it had all that in it too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now with DVDs, there's all these, you know, director's cuts where they just put everything back in, and those sell far more copies than the R-rated versions do.
Mm-hmm. Now, Richard Band, who did the score of the film, there's a lot of controversy on the score of the movie as far as, like, it's very Bernard Herrmann-esque, I guess.
Yes, and that was intentional. I mean, he was, you know, doing a kind of an homage to Bernard Herrmann and actually even wanted us to put a thing in the credits saying, "With apologies to Bernard Herrmann." But somehow that got left out, and poor Richard has had to take the heat, you know, ever since.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any, you know, backlash with maybe legal problems with that? Or
we got a letter from Bernard Herrmann's estate saying that if Bernard Herrmann were alive, they would sue us.
God.
So they were not pleased. No, yeah. They were not happy about it.
Okay, so the film, it comes out and stuff like that. Where did you see it the first time? Did you see it with a group or, I mean, the full completed film?
We did, I think, our first kind of test screening was in San Francisco, and we opened it at a theater, and we did it kind of William Castle style. We had, you know, ambulances taking people out on stretchers and so forth,
mm-hmm.
You know, while the other, you know, the next audience is waiting in line to come in. So it was a lot of fun, and, you know, it was the first time I saw it with an audience, and at the end, you know, as, you know, Barbara Crampton's character is lying on the table, and, you know, the question is whether he's going to reanimate her or not. Somebody in the audience yelled out, "Use the juice!" And that's when I knew the movie was working.
Now, I know that the juice itself was the glow stick stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Did you have to do anything else with the camera to make it look so bright, or was it just like that?
No, I mean, no, it really just worked. You know, it was an effect that just was, you know, it was a stage effect, you know, or a floor effect, I guess they would call it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have to do any opticals or anything with it.
Wow.
We did have to keep, you know, replacing it because it would start losing, you know, its brightness after a couple hours. So we had a lot of it kicking around.
Okay.
So I guess the next film, too, would have been, was it From Beyond that was made?
Well, before we go on to From Beyond, I want to mention that right now I'm doing a musical version of Reanimated
in
Los Angeles, which has been really hugely successful. And I'm hoping that, you know, we're going to be taking it off, you know, taking it on the road soon.
With the Reanimator musical, though, I mean, there's been several, like Evil Dead the musical, I guess, was the first one I heard of like that.
Well, I think it actually goes way back even earlier, you know, with Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The idea of taking a horror movie and turning it into a musical. You know, in a way, it is kind of a subgenre of musicals now. There have been a lot of them. You know, Evil Dead, as you mentioned, is one. But, yeah, I'm having a great time with it.
I mean, do you have the splatter row?
We do.
Yeah.
It's the first four rows now because the splatter is getting bigger and bigger the longer we run the show.
Now, as far as
We're using several gallons of blood a night, as a matter of fact.
Very cool. The sequels to Reanimator, though, were you interested at all in doing those, or is that just something you were going to let Brian Usna do?
Yeah, I actually was working on other things, and I, at the time, was more interested in doing new work rather than, you know, sticking with the Reanimator franchise. So Brian, you know, kind of took that on himself.
Hmm. Had you seen any of them?
Yeah, oh, sure, I've seen them all.
Hmm. And I remember at one time, too, there was some talk about maybe a House of Reanimator or something like that.
Yeah, I was hoping to do that, you know, a few years back, and it was going to be about the Bush administration. Set in the White House, you know, and Herbert West has to reanimate Dick Cheney.
God.
Wishful thinking on my part.
I think that may have already happened, and we just didn't know.
Yeah, probably.
Actually, like, I think you were working with the Empire Pictures. You were signed on for a couple more movies right after Reanimator.
Yeah, they signed me to a three-picture deal, and I did Dolls, From Beyond, and Robojocks were the three pictures, and shot them all in Italy.
Wow.
At that point, Charlie Band had bought this huge studio there that had been built by Dino De Laurentiis, and it was like working at Universal, these gigantic sound stages. Yeah, it was very exciting. It was fun.
It's not a bad place to have a directing gig in Italy.
No, it's, you know, it's a wonderful place. And, you know, I love the fact that the crew kept calling me Maestro. I thought that was wonderful.
Now, in From Beyond, though, you worked a lot with the same cast of Reanimator and brought on Ken Foree.
Yeah, that's right. Ken was great.
Was that an audition process, or did you just handpick him?
I think he did come in and read for it, you know, but I was familiar with his work, you know, from Dawn of the Dead, and the idea of having him in the movie just made perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
And From Beyond, that continues the H.P. Lovecraft theme, right? And I remember somebody saying that the film itself is, like, the opening is the whole book or something like that?
Well, it's a short story, you know. It's one of, you know, Lovecraft's stories sometimes are very short. I think From Beyond is only, like, 7 or 8 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of ran out of story with the pre-title sequence. So it was kind of like, well, now what happens?
And yeah.
We had to kind of make up sort of a, you know, kind of a Lovecraft pastiche, I guess I'd call it.
Mm-hmm. And I'd heard, too, that when they re-released the DVD a few years ago, that you just stumbled across the uncut footage.
It was really fantastic. I thought that, the MPAA really, you know, with From Beyond, Charlie said, now this one has to get an R rating. You have to plan on getting an R rating with this. It's a piece, as they cut tons of stuff out of it. And it was very, very depressing. I was really upset about it. And for years afterwards, people kept asking me, are you going to do a director's cut and put it all back in? And I went and tried to find the material that had been cut out and it had been lost. I couldn't find it. And I just sort of said, I guess it's never going to happen. And then a few years ago, the film, you know, kind of, it changed hands several times and ended up at MGM. And the guys at MGM called me up one day and said, we found this little can, this film can, and there's some trims in it. We're not sure what they are. Can you come and take a look at them? It was kind of like being called to the morgue to identify a loved one or something. And, you know, I went down to, you know, look at them, and there they were. It was all of the little trims. Our editor had put them in a film can with a note on it saying, you know, for the video release. And we were able to put them back to, you know, kind of restore the picture, which was due to the, you know, wonders of CG, really.
Mm-hmm.
Because these were trims that had been marked with grease pencils, and they were all scratched up, and, you know, they trying to put them into this pristine print that they were using to do the DVD without, you know, calling attention to them was really difficult. But we had some great technicians who were really able to do it seamlessly. And so the movie was put back the way it was supposed to be in the first place, and that just made me feel so good. It's like 20 years later, but better late than never.
Oh, yeah. And it does look really good, too.
Now,
yeah, it's beautiful. I'm really pleased with it.
These movies you did with Charles Band, though, after Reanimator, how wide of a release did these get in theaters? I mean, were they pretty much everywhere like today, or was it a limited?
Well, I mean, you know, today it's like, you know, you've got 4,000 prints, you know, coming out on a weekend, you know. And back in the days when this was happening, I think a big release was maybe 1,000 prints. And mm-hmm. so we were, you know, that was probably like the level that they were released at, mm-hmm. something close to that.
Mm-hmm. I know Dolls, which was another one that you did shortly. Mm-hmm. I think you did that before From Beyond, but it didn't.
It wasn't released until later because it had really extensive stop-motion effects in it, and it'll take a long time to do.
But that was definitely the first in a long line of the killer doll and puppet movies and stuff like that at the time. Do you think that was the movie that really inspired Charles Band to keep doing like the Puppet Master movies that came out a couple of years later? And
Charlie, I have to say, likes these little creatures, you know. You know, he did those movies, the movies called Ghoulies, you know, before he did Reanimator. And those are these little guys, you know, sort of like little monsters running around. So he likes little things that, you know, run after you, I guess. So I think Charlie had the idea of, you know, Dolls was just kind of a natural step in that direction. And then he continued on with the Puppet Master series. Although I always thought it was interesting that he used Guy Rolfe, who was in Dolls, he became the Puppet Master.
Yeah, they're actually still making Puppet Master movies, which is hard to believe.
I know. Still popular.
And Child's Play was another one that came out, I guess, a year or two later, and that was a huge success. And there's a lot of connections there, I always thought, with Dolls as well. But
well, you know, Dolls, I mean, the idea of, you know, some killer dolls, it's something, it's, I wish I could say that it was, you know, I invented it, but I remember even Twilight Zone episodes. There was one that was called Talking Tina, I think it was, about a killer doll. So, and there was an episode, I think, that was done with Karen Black being chased around by like a little...
Oh, yeah, sort of Trilogy of Terror, yeah.
Trilogy of Terror, yeah, which is great. And that was, you know, same sort of idea. So, yeah, I think it's, again, it's killer doll movies is its own kind of thing.
Now, how was that movie filmed? Because I remember you said a little bit earlier too that there was like a whole unit, I guess, that did all the stop motion stuff. And then you filmed all the live action stuff in between that and kind of pieced it together?
You know, we did like mechanical dolls and puppet dolls and you name it, we did it.
I imagine it had to be like maddening to have all that stuff in there though, with all the effects and the dolls and stuff.
It was crazy. It was, yeah, it was, some of it was very complicated. But it was fun. It was, you know, I had a great time working on that movie.
I can't remember isn't there a sequence in Dolls where, like, the dolls pick up a woman and, like, ram her head into a door or something?
Yeah,
that
right.
It's like, that has to be hard to film something like that.
Well, it was. It was, yeah, it was tricky, but it was, We had a really good, you know, effects group on that film, and it seemed like anything was possible.
Now, something I always wanted to ask you about, because it's just a complete 360 from the stuff that you did before, is the Disney movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which you were
credited. Yeah, Brian Wilson and I, you know, worked on that together. And we used Ed Naha, who wrote Dolls, to write the screenplay. So it was kind of a natural outgrowth, I think, of what we were doing in a way. People are sort of surprised, you know, that we did a Disney movie, but when you think about it, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids is about a mad scientist who
has
terrible experiments, you know, and giant insects and all kinds of horror movie stuff. You know, I think it is a horror movie, except it's a for the whole family.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, if it was originally a little bit darker of a movie as far as the tone goes, and you just changed it into a family movie, or because
I mean it was one of the things that, you know, I tried to do with it was I wanted it to have a sense of danger about it. You know, the idea that these kids, even though, you know, it's, you know, they're so small that going through the backyard is like being trapped in the Amazon jungle, and it's a very dangerous place to be. And so I wanted the sense that the kids could, you know, something terrible could happen to them, someone could step on them, or an insect could eat them or something, you know. So I wanted there to be that kind of tension in the film. And I think there is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really great movie, especially like there's not too many of the Disney movies that are, in my opinion, for like the whole family that really everyone can enjoy. But that's definitely one that I've always.
Yeah, that's what Disney wanted to do. You know, he used to say that he didn't make children's movies; he made family films, and the difference being that you know everybody could see it together and enjoy it.
Also, though, a movie that not a lot of people talk about is Castle Freak, which I guess came out around that day, which I think was, I mean, we watched that movie not too long ago. It's just an amazing film, but it's got some really friggin' bizarre sequences in it, like with some of the sex scenes in it, and
it's a very, very disturbing film. I just saw it again recently myself, and I had kind of forgotten about how strong that movie is. And again, some wonderful performances by Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton, and it's got a great cast.
I guess, I mean, at that point, you did so many movies with Jeffrey Combs. Is he like your go-to guy, like the actor that, I mean, you go to for all these movies?
Yeah, he is, absolutely. You know, I think every actor, you know, every director has sort of his favorite actors. I mean, like Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro and, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's like, you know, there's certain actors that you just associate with certain directors, you know, Hitchcock and Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant. So Jeffrey Combs is my Cary Grant.
Yeah, I always thought that Jeffrey Combs should be way more famous than he is. I mean, he is famous and everything, but like...
Well, he thinks so too.
But I mean, he's one of those guys that's just great in everything that you see him in. I mean, no matter, you know, The Return of the House on Haunted Hill is a bad movie, but he was great in it, you know.
No, he is a great actor, and he's... I think he's our sort of generation's answer to someone like Vincent Price.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he's right up there with those guys or Boris Karloff. I mean, these guys were great actors who did a lot of great work. But no one ever really, you know, took them seriously because they were making horror films.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and one thing, skipping forward a bit to more like present day, you were with the Masters of Horror series too, and I think that episode that you did was probably as good as any horror film that I had seen in years up to that point too, which was the Black Cat one.
Oh, thank you.
And his performance in that was just like,
yeah, it's spectacular. He really is. He channels Poe, and as a result, you know, we did a play based on you know, with him playing Poe. You know, he does a play called Nevermore that I directed, which is an evening with Edgar Allan Poe, and you really do feel like you're hanging out with the man himself.
I mean, did you guys do research about the man? Did you talk about?
And Dennis Paoli, you know, my old writing partner. I mean, he's an expert on Gothic literature, so he really knows a lot about Poe. And you know, he made sure that everything that we portrayed was really true.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Masters of Horror series, you did two episodes, and then you did The Fear Itself, which was sort of the spinoff of Masters of Horror. Were you kind of, I know that we were kind of upset that Showtime only gave the series like two seasons. Do you think like we'll ever see something like that again happen?
Boy, I sure hope so. It was such fun to be working on that and to be able to be in the same company as those, you know, other directors. But what a group, you know, John Carpenter and Joe Dante and Toby Hooper. I mean, it was just like, you know, the best and Mike and, I mean, these are like, it was like the all-star team of horror directors. It was a great series. And it was actually not Showtime that ended up canceling the show. Showtime wanted it to keep going. It was actually the second highest rated show that Showtime ever had. What happened was the company that was producing it, was sold to another, you know, group of people who just didn't appreciate the show.
I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, you were on that show, you worked on it. What was your opinion about the whole Takashi Miike thing where they, I guess they flipped out about his episode and all that?
Yeah, they didn't want to air it, and I thought that was terrible. I mean, my feeling was part of the deal was that we were given all, you know, complete freedom to do whatever we wanted to do. So for them to turn around and decide not to air that episode, I thought was kind of a betrayal. You know, it was really a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, we had Mick Garris on the show a couple of years ago, and the Masters of Horror sort of came about from these dinners that you guys would have, the ideas
and
stuff.
Yeah, we just had one last night, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was really great. It was fun. Yeah, everybody was there.
is that something you guys still talk about, though, maybe wanting to do another series similar?
Well, we would love to. I think the problem has been that anthology series, people just feel that they just don't work. And of course, I disagree. I think they're really great. And I love the old shows like The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. So I think there really would be an audience for a show like that. But it's hard to convince the TV people that that is true.
Now, Fear Itself, which only lasted like one season, could you tell that was something that probably wasn't going to last past the first year? Was there like a lot of tension in the air from the? Because
well,
this was
it
like
was being done by NBC, yeah. You know, so it was network television, and whereas with Showtime and Masters of Horror, we were given, as I said, a lot of freedom. On this one, there was all these standards and practices issues. But I think in spite of that, we were still able to do some pretty strong stuff. I mean, I think what happened with that show was that it got caught. The Olympics were happening that year, and the Summer Olympics. And so we only did they only aired like 8 episodes, and then the Olympics came out, and that was that. So they never went back to it.
Hmm.
But it's too bad. It would be great if we could get the Masters of Horror up and running again.
Hmm. I mean, you are definitely what I would consider to be a master of horror. I mean, you are right up there with all the other guys, Carpenter, Craven, Hooper, Argento, all those guys. So it seems to me that you've got your own little niche in terms of you. I don't think you've ever made a slasher that I know of. Like, I think Dolls would probably be the closest thing to a slasher film. Like, how would you describe, like, the kind of films that you make, like, the area that you like to make films in?
I don't know. It's a hard question to answer. I think my movies are about people discovering that they are the monsters, I think is the way I would put it. You know, a lot of the movies are like that, you know, where someone who seems like a normal person ends up doing something monstrous. And the last film that I did, Stuck, was really like that as well.
Yeah, that was based on a true story, though, right? I mean, it was...
It was. It was based on an event that took place in Fort Worth, where a woman hit a homeless guy, and he goes through the windshield of her car, and instead of taking him to the emergency room, she puts him in her garage and keeps coming back to seeing if he's still alive and apologizing to him when he is. It was an awful story.
It's kind of a surreal film too when you watch it, and she just keeps going back out there, and the guy's just in the garage, like hanging out, and how he kind of just tries to pry himself loose out of this car is the basic gist of the film. While she's running around trying to act like everything's normal.
Yeah, that she's trying to keep her life together. That was the question, and the thing that was really the most disturbing about that story was that the woman was a caregiver at a senior citizen's home.
Right.
So it was like, well, here's a woman who's normally being very kind to people and taking care of them, and all of a sudden she turns into this kind of unfeeling, cold monster. And that to me was what was fascinating about that story. What would make someone do that?
Now, as far as movies that you're trying to get off the ground today, would you just rather work with independent studios, or if you had an offer from a mainstream studio, like what would be your choice?
Well, it would be wonderful to work with a studio that could actually, distribute the movies the way they should be. I mean, I think the big studios are the only ones that can do that these days. So that would be great. Although I wouldn't want to do, it seems like all they want to do now are remakes and sequels and things like that. And so to me, it's all about doing new work, original work. So that's something that the studios, they're afraid of taking chances.
Mm-hmm.
So the most interesting movies are being done, by independent filmmakers on a much smaller scale.
What are the movies, that interest you now?
Well, I just saw this movie recently that completely blew me away. It's called The Serbian Film.
Oh, God. Yeah, we've heard about it. I don't think we've seen it. Neither one of us has seen it.
That is, like, one of the strongest movies I've ever seen, and very well made, as a matter of fact. But just kind of like, you just are genuinely horrified by that movie. It's very, very strong, very powerful.
Yeah, we've heard about some of the the stuff that's in it, the content of it. It's, yeah, it sounds like
I don't even
really
think we can say what the content of it is.
You really can't, but it's, I mean, it's basically, the basic idea of it is it's about a porn star who gets hired to make this porno movie, and they're paying him, like 10 times or 100 times what they usually pay him, but he's got to do the most awful things you can imagine in that film. And he's kind of forced into doing them. And he's got guys holding guns on him if he doesn't.
Yeah.
And, and they can inject him with drugs that make him do all these things. So he has no control of what he's doing. So it's a very, very strong thing. And I think it's about something, too. The fact that it's called a Serbian film, it really is about what happened in Serbia, with Bosnia, about the kinds of monstrous things that people did during that war.
I just wonder, though, after a movie like that, do you think that anything can really shock people? I mean, sure, that surely did.
Well, I think, that's what it showed. If you pull out all the stops, you still can, blow people's minds. And I think that's what we're all trying to do.
I mean, Imprint kind of did that, too. I think that's kind of why it just went in an area that nobody really wanted to go. I think that's kind of what happened with that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the things about Mike. I mean, Audition was one of those movies, too, where he just really went to some really dark places. And, it's very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, would you have a film that you would say at this stage, like, sums up what you wanted to do, or like a film that you think puts out there what you're capable of the best?
Well, I think I'd have to say my next one.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the just where the genre is heading right now, as far as like mainstream cinema goes, like it seems like horror is in a little bit of a slump right now.
I don't know if I would agree with that. I think that one of the things that about horror that to me is really interesting is that it's become kind of international, and that you're seeing movies coming from all these different places. Places that normally in the past didn't really do that much horror, like the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing some really great, really strong. And Korea. I think there's been some sort of a renaissance of horror, but it's a worldwide renaissance. And there've been some great movies made in the U.S. as well.
Mm-hmm. At the Masters of Horror dinners that you guys have, are you talking about stuff like this? I mean, I imagine.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Just be talking about the Red Wings or something. I mean, I don't know how those things go.
Well, it's true. Sometimes we talk about things, completely that have nothing to do with making horror movies. But, when someone does something really amazing, everybody wants to talk about it or meet the person who did it. And very often those people will join us for dinner, which is great.
Yeah, that has to
one
be.
Of the one of the people that was at the dinner last night was Alex Aja.
Oh yeah,
Who made Attention, High Tension.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great to meet him. I mean, he's a terrific filmmaker.
He also made Piranha 3D recently too.
Yeah, I know, and he was talking about that. I haven't seen that movie. I want to see it. It sounds great.
Yeah, it's definitely right out of the 80s.
It's like a lot of fun. Yeah,
it's something you would.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He said he really intended it to be a comedy.
It just seems like, though, I mean, with a guy like that that just has so much talent, that after High Tension, I don't know if he's done anything that wasn't like a remake. I mean, that seems to be all the studio.
Well, that's what happens. That's what the studios want him to
do.
They kind of grabbed him up and said, okay, now we need you to do The Hills Have Eyes. That's the only kind of movies they want to make are these remakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like you were saying, it doesn't seem like the mainstream studios take any chances anymore on movies, and that's why we're really not seeing anything different out there.
But I think that's always been the way it was. When you think about it, all the really great horror films were these little movies,
mm-hmm.
That just came out of nowhere, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Night of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm.
These were not done by big studios.
I believe Halloween was an independent movie, too, at the time.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it might have gotten a distribution through a major, but it was a very small little production that just kind of came out of nowhere.
Hmm. So, okay, you got the Reanimator musical right now, right? That's going on right now?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What, are there film projects you got lined up right now, or are you writing?
I'm working on a couple of things that are pretty interesting. I'm actually working, one of the projects is a script by Dan O'Bannon, who is a good friend of mine. He's the guy who wrote Alien.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping to get that made. It's called The Men. So that could be something that comes up next.
Wow, he recently passed away too, didn't he?
Not he did, sadly. Yeah. I mean, what a great writer and a good friend, and also a terrific director himself. You know, he did some really great work. He did Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah, definitely. It's like one of our favorites, too.
Yeah, no, he's wonderful.
One last thing, though, as far as the remakes go, how would you feel if a studio got a hold of Reanimator and remade it? That's one that hasn't been touched yet.
I kind of think it's only a matter of time before they do it, you know. And I really have no way of, you know, preventing that from happening. I would just hope that if they do it, that they do it well.
I mean, would you have anything to do with it if they ask you to, like, come on as a producer or anything?
No, I don't think so.
Well, that's good.
I kind of feel like I've done that movie already, you know. Yeah.
Hi, this is Doc Bradley, Pinhead from the Hellraiser movies, and you are listening to DadPit.com.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
That was an awesome interview with Stuart Gordon. I couldn't believe it. We actually finally got to do it.
I know, and a big thanks to Stuart Gordon for coming on and giving us any amount of his time, really, but it just goes to show, though. I mean, we have done interviews with some of the most influential horror directors of all time, and we can definitely say that we added Stuart Gordon on that list.
I know.
Thank you, buddy.
I know Jess was really impressed by us finally getting Stuart Gordon on the
show. She actually was, I think.
I was. I'm very happy.
Were you proud of us?
Very proud. You guys did good.
Thank you.
So, of course, it is Jess's segment. This is the only segment she shows up for nowadays, and it's starting to make me mad.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
She thinks she's kind of a big deal now.
I only show up for one thing.
It is the most highly rated segment on Deadbeat.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moral, moral, moral.
Fire! He gets worse every time. You guys have like mini seizures.
Or it gets better.
No, it gets worse.
So,
now let's explore deep inside the chasm that is.
It is like cavernous.
It's ooey. It's gooey.
Why is it gooey and ooey and cavernous and just?
It's filled with danger and plunder.
Aaron likes to get deep into the bag and guzzle some of the fluid out of it.
I like to get knee deep inside the mailbag.
Oh, come on! That is just gross.
No. I will
That's
say
bad fluid, boy.
This was fucking killer. I'm glad you did that because it reminded me. We were just in Walmart, and this son of a bitch, we're standing looking at like wrestling figures over there. All of a sudden, he decides to let out one of the god-awful fucking farts of all time.
Yeah, it wasn't
and
just...
And then, like...
It wasn't just loud, though. It
stank. It smelled like rotted potatoes or something.
It was nasty.
Anyway, we walk away to, like, get out of it, and all of a sudden, like... Just a couple seconds later, I hear these little kids like run over into that same thing. Oh, look at all the figures! And you just know they ran into that shit fog and was like, oh God, what the hell's that?
Yeah, it did. Like, it was one of those that seemed to linger around as I was walking. Like, it was just like oozing out of the butt cheeks.
Oh, God.
It followed us. It followed us like to the next aisle.
It did. I was proud.
Anyway, that little kid was like, I'm sure they're like, Mommy, something died right here.
No, the sad thing is most little kids around here, that probably smells better than their bedroom. They're probably like, ooh, what's this perfume, Mom? Those old Kearney fuckers around here don't take their baths or anything.
They smell like their bedroom. It's like home.
It's a dream to them.
So anyway,
we do have a, we don't have that deep of a bag this week, to be honest with you. And there's a couple reasons behind that. Well, one of the big reasons is we've changed the Dead Pit universe. That's where you need to go to ask you questions, or the Dead Pit message board. So go to the Facebook universe, facebook.com, Dead Pit Universe.
The new one.
The new one.
Yeah,
you can't post, because I've changed, you can't actually post anything on the old one anymore.
Well, what's it up for then? Just take the damn thing down?
It's up for archive reasons.
Okay.
We've got all of our videos and shit up there as well.
Let's go ahead and get this
We should delete it.
Yeah,
we probably should.
It's confusing.
That's true.
Anywho, so the first question is from Manic Exorcism. He says, "You guys rock."
Thank you.
Thanks for taking time to read my bullshit on your show. I'm always flattered by that. So now, to be a brother, let me ask you about some really interesting films. Have you guys ever seen the movies Bad Biology?
Mm-hmm.
Pervert?
Mm-mm.
Sex Galaxy? And or Farts of Darkness?
Farts of Darkness was awesome. No, I think we have seen Pervert. If you remember, it's that one that had Mary Carey, like the porn star in it. We watched it a long time ago.
Well, I don't remember it if we did.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember it kind of being like a throwback to 70s style sex comedies like they used to have.
I always hated those.
Yeah. But what was the first one they made?
Bad Biology.
Bad Biology,
we
yeah.
reviewed that one not too long ago.
Yeah, there's a review
like
of that.
When it came out, like... probably about a year ago, something like that.
I mean, we love Hinlotter's stuff. I mean, at least I do. I like all of his stuff.
Yeah, Hinlotter's off the chain, yo, but like the other ones, I don't really remember them.
I thought Babology was a great return for...
To me, though, like Pervert or whatever, if you can't remember anything about it, how good was it, seriously?
I don't think it was good. I just remember it being like... that kind of movie, that kind of Roger Corman, Russ Meyer type of movie.
Yeah.
He says, you can find them all on Netflix, and yes, I do love plugging them. They offer the strangest things.
I don't like Netflix.
Well, he don't talk shit about Netflix.
I've never used Netflix.
I've used it.
What is it about Netflix? It's like $8 a month. Why is that so horrible?
No, the thing is, like... okay, if you're going to use it as streaming, you know, if you got one of those newer TVs where you can stream stuff from your, you know, DVD player, whatever, TV, it'd be worth $8 a month for that, I guess. But, like, when I had it, they were mainly just doing the stuff where they send you the discs. And for $8 a month, you could only have one disc at a time, and you had to send them back. And for a month, like, I think I had it for like 2 or 3 months, and you would average maybe 3 DVDs a month.
Yeah, that's kind of bad.
Just because it was so slow.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, I mean, maybe just this area, if you were in a bigger city, maybe it wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah, I guess the streaming stuff, though, that would be a lot better, a lot faster now.
Yeah, but I'm going to do my best not to support any kind of streaming shit, because I don't like it.
Mike Morrissey says, have you ever seen the film The Wanderers? If so, what are your thoughts?
I don't think we've seen
it. I've heard the song The Wanderer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I've never seen the movie.
He says, I love the movie. It has definitely become one of my all-time favorite films. I love the soundtrack and the storyline. Also, the book is 10 times better than the film.
Well, they call him the Wanderer. Call him the Wanderer. He runs around doodly fucking.
Oh, God. He says, and have you ever seen the TV show Wise Guy?
No.
He said he...
We're not really helping these people out too much, are we?
No.
I don't watch a lot of TV shows, to be honest with you. Jess is more of the TV aficionado.
I never even heard of it.
Me either. I remember a movie called Wise Guy, though. It had, like,
Vin Diesel in it.
Yeah, wasn't there a movie like that?
No, it's called, I think it's called like Knock Around Guys or something.
Yeah, but there was a movie called, I think it had Danny DeVito in it or something like that.
I think so. I think that's what you're talking
about.
No, I
think that was, what was the name of that?
Nice Guys?
It wasn't Wise Guys. It was, you talking about the one with Bette Midler?
No, that's Ruthless
People.
Of course, there's been about 10 he's been in with Bette Midler.
Ruthless People was funny, though.
Ruthless People!
I actually remember liking that. I hate Bette Midler.
She cracked me up in that movie. He says, I recently watched season one from Netflix. Here's another Netflix. It was an outstanding series, and I think it was very underrated.
Yeah. We're sorry, Mike. I'm sorry it wasn't real.
Sorry.
I did actually, I watched probably about two or three episodes of that show. I know Jess talks about it, Justified or something like that.
Yeah, I like that. I haven't watched the last season, though.
I gotta say, it's probably the best thing that Timothy Oliphant's ever been
in. Told you, it's a good show.
It has
to
be. I mean, because he actually does do a decent job in that, and I hate to admit it.
Yeah, I hate to admit it too, so fuck him.
You need to calm down. Why do you hate him so much?
Hope he fucking dies.
That's mean. Timothy Oliphant is...
He hates him so much because you dream about his Peter.
I just don't like him.
Ooh, Timothy Oliphant's Vainy Peter.
Oh, God.
Vainy Peter.
Anyway, Abby, she wrote in.
Hi, Abby.
Hi, Abby.
Hi, Abs.
She says, hey, guys and gal. I had been wanting to write in for a while, but could never think of a question to ask. This is the best I can come up with. What are some of your favorite moments on the show? Shit. I think mine was when... I don't know, I just remember it when we were sitting, I was sitting over there in the corner and we were talking about old man balls and then you were talking about how when they sag and they get in the toilet and then you said,
pickle your butt sack.
Yeah. I remember I was crying. Just for that, just cause I think you didn't mean to say it and I just started bawling cause it was so funny.
Oh my God.
Well, that's difficult because, golly, we've done so many shows. I would say, like, the ones that are more memorable to me are the stuff that didn't happen that we were thinking was going to happen. Like, I'll be honest with you. I know Aaron, Uncle Bill over there. Up until Horror Hound last year, always been supportive of trauma and stuff like that. And I remember this was probably 4 years ago, at least, when we interviewed Lloyd Kaufman. Okay. And we had a, set time to call at the trauma offices. Okay. So we call, it was about 12 o'clock in the day I think it was on a weekday because neither of us had a job then. So we could call on a weekdays and we got a lot more interviews and shit then. But, so we call at 12 o'clock and they keep delaying it and it's delayed for an hour. And then, we call back and then they tell us to call a certain number. And it's evidently Lloyd Kaufman's house. They gave us the Lloyd Kaufman's house, his home phone number. And, we call him and it's clear that he just woke up or something. And he was like, not Lloyd Kaufman that you see. Like, do you remember how he was acting like briefly? He wasn't Lloyd Kaufman you see at conventions or on.
Yeah, he was just like TV. A normal guy.
He was like, hello, who's this? You know, real short, let me call you back or something. And then I just really, really was like, fuck this fucking guy. Because after a while, like, we waited. There was the only person that's ever done us like that. Where we had to wait like 3 or 4 hours to do that fucking interview, which sucked dick anyway, the interview did, in my opinion. Because the guy never broke character. He never does when he actually, you know. And it's stuff like that, like... the interview stuff, like the fucking Gary Clark thing, or, oh God.
I do remember that was probably one of the most memorable experiences ever, because that interview lasted like altogether probably about 3.5-4 hours long.
Yeah.
And I can just remember, like, when we were doing that, it became clear to us at some point that we were not going to
way. There's no stopping. Yeah,
that you couldn't redirect him, nor could you, like, get it a word in edgewise or anything like that. So I just remember sitting here, and we're doing an interview, and, like, looking over, and Wes, or I'm sorry, CK had gone in there and fucking got, like, a pancake breakfast or something, was over eating it while he was talking. We just get up and like fucking walk and go use the bathroom.
He
had no idea that we were doing anything.
No, because we never said shit. No. Like, he was talking the entire time.
Huh. We could have.
I seriously ate an entire breakfast without saying shit. Like, occasionally, like, Uncle Bill was like, mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah.
Oh. Mm. That was it. He was going to. It was almost like he was, like, reading a fucking book the entire time, you know, and didn't need us at all.
I remember one time you asked him something, trying to, like, redirect him towards the movie, like, Day of the Dead, and he was like, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I just want to give you, like, all this so you'll have, like,
you have all of it.
And it was, like, another hour and a half before we got to the actual movie.
Yeah. Well, there's actually, like, a lot of memorable things, though, that nobody heard. Like, we've got bloopers.
Yeah, that's what I was sitting there thinking. The most memorable stuff is stuff we probably couldn't put on the show either.
We've got bloopers saved up. We've got probably, like, 30-some-odd blooper files that we've saved that are fucking hilarious. Or just various shit that has happened, like posters falling off the damn wall in the middle of us saying something.
Just messing up words and, like,
noodles.
Saying weird shit and
noodles interfering.
Yeah, talking about people and stuff like that we can never put on the air. But another thing too I think of is like how many people have been callers on the show or written into the show that we ended up being in some sort of fucking feud with. Those feuds are always really memorable in my mind too.
One that I always remember is not really a feud, but just something that was hilarious. It was actually on the, I guess, be the MySpace show, back when it was the MySpace show. The Fulci Fanterra thing.
Oh, God.
Which,
a lot of people may not remember this, but one time there was a guy that posted on the message board and was a fan of the show, and for whatever reason, we'll never know his, like, motives behind doing this, acted like he was a woman. Like, he would post...
Well, the funny thing is, Jess, do you remember this at all? The Fulci Fanterra thing?
No.
Okay. This guy, I'm not going to make fun of how anybody looks or nothing, okay? The guy was, you know, just your normal... Well, I don't even know if he'd be normal. Anyway... This guy is on Facebook, right? I knew he was a fan of the show. I was not about to be mean, disrespectful, because I'm not like that. I'm not like that to people just to do that, to be mean. And I noticed on his Facebook that he's married to Tara, to a girl named Tara. And I look at Tara, and Tara is fucking model material, hot. You know, I mean, she's... got the tattoos and stuff and got the real bright, you know, neon hair and shit. But she's smoking hot. And this guy, I'm like, that just doesn't make sense. And this happened after I started chatting with her because she just started messaging me. I'm like, holy shit, this girl's hotter than hell. Who the fuck is this? Is this really her? So I started chatting with her and stuff, and she, you know.
You gonna eat my titties?
It never got to that, thankfully. Regardless of what anybody would fucking want to think. But I noticed, like, actually it was the other way around. I noticed that she was married to fucking, supposedly, Mike Knox. And I was like, there's something fucking wrong. This ain't right. So... she was actually saying that she was a model for the Suicide Girls and stuff like that. So I'm like, I've got to just fucking because I know a couple people from Suicide Girls. I've got to, like, contact them and be like, hey, I think there's somebody impersonating one of your, just to see what they would say. And sure enough, it was not real. It was, sadly enough, Mike Knott, whatever his name is, Mike Knott or something like that, Mike Knox. It was, I believe it was actually him acting like,
her.
Trying to impress people with a fake wife.
So it wasn't a girl, it was a man?
It was that man that was a fan of our show acting like he was a really hot woman.
Why?
I don't know.
To impress people, I guess?
That's
I
don't weird.
Know. Oh, yeah.
But yeah, all this stuff, like, we were talking about, like, you know, if we do the Dead Pit members thing, that would probably be one of the first things that we'd put up is like an extra thing that people, because you can't really, that's nowhere online right now. We took a lot of that stuff offline.
Yeah, I mean, and for just the sheer number of favorite experiences, the call-in show, the call-in portion of the show probably had some really memorable things happen.
Undoubtedly.
Where you had like friggin' guy from Scotland calling and we couldn't fucking understand a word he was saying while he was talking. So we just sat there for like 20 minutes, however long he was on, trying to understand one word he was saying.
It was like trying to understand Jess when she first started coming around.
Oh, whatever.
No, it wasn't nearly.
John! No, it's you guys I can't understand.
You can understand us now.
A little bit, yeah.
Bullshit.
Balls, let me tell you something.
Taters.
Get you a tater. Eat on a mater.
What?
Tater? What's a tater?
A potato.
What's a mater?
A tomato.
Oh, hell yeah, I'm impressed.
What's a Tommy toe?
That's a baby tomato. I just found that out today.
What if I took a baby tomato and just smashed it? Would that make you mad?
Oh, it's a baby tomato. He killed a baby tomato.
Oh, we seen a dead bird today. It made me so sad.
Anyway, you don't want to get off on that tangent. The point I was trying to make was that there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things that happens on the call-in portion that I really remember. That being one. Remember, like, Tiffany Shepp was calling in and stuff on the call-in portion. And, like,
Rolf Konieski called in. Kelly Maroney called in one time.
Yeah, and just the stuff that would happen on there was fucking hilarious sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point we do need to do at least one call-in show just to, you know, bring back the good old days.
We're bringing back sexy to the call-in portion. Okay.
Okay. Darren, I can't pronounce this guy's name. Darren.
Hi.
Hi. Says,
it's locked.
You guys ever gonna review a Serbian film?
No.
Says that's a pretty disgusting movie. I'm never gonna watch it.
I'd rather take a fucking beating than watch that movie.
It definitely, you gotta give it this though. It ushered in the baby raping, you know, subgenre.
Yeah,
that's true.
Because there is a real big demand for baby rape.
That's true.
Yeah, there's like two or three people that we know that probably love baby rape.
We both did order though the Human Centipede on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I did. That was another one I got. I forgot.
Yeah, you got that one.
So we get to see some shit eating in HD, and I'm looking forward to it.
The other one too, I think I got was Starship Troopers.
That's one with Tim Allen.
Huh?
Tim Allen is in that one.
Tim Allen.
Isn't that Starship Troopers?
No, that's Galaxy Quest.
Oh, that's Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
But yeah, Amazon had a sale recently. It's actually going. It's only like for 24 hours, I think. The sale went on for, and they had like a ton of movies for $6.
I got some, Jessica. I got six of them. Shit, yeah. I got the Scream movies.
You believe the Scream movies are already $6?
No, that's weird.
That is weird.
Lionsgate stuff always hits really cheap, though, after.
Tim Goodall says, have you guys heard about a Creepshow television spinoff?
Mm-hmm.
Says, apparently the dude that played
Fez on that 70s
show. Oh, Fez. I was like, F-E-S. Fez on that 70s show directed a pilot for it in 2009.
I never heard of it.
I have no idea. I never heard anything about it. That guy was actually in a horror movie, though, called, it was about voodoo. Do you remember it? I think we watched it.
Beyond the Valley of the Voodoo Jew. That was a really great one.
He said it so matter-of-factly, too, like that's the name of it.
It was something like, I don't know, it was not too long ago. I knew he had some kind of connection to horror films, though, but he's not the guy that I would actually peg to write a Creepshow series or direct a Creepshow series.
I don't think
series.
That's going to happen. I've never heard of that.
He dated somebody that. Or something like that. I remember that. There's some chick he dated.
El Muerto. I think that was it.
Elmo?
El Muerto.
He dated Elmo?
El Muerto.
Elmo Muerto?
El Camino.
El Camino.
Okay, here we go. Cody.
Hey, hey Jessica.
What?
Can you okay?
Can I K?
K? See?
See?
K.
Mogwai?
Gay?
K is smooth mojo.
K? I don't know what.
Mokulovo. La Bamba? Le Mesesico?
Pacifico?
Polquitere, polquitere. La, la, bamba. La, la, bamba. La, la, bamba. Breakfast burrito. Breakfast burrito at McDonald's. Who says we're racist?
How dare they?
People just need to lighten up.
All right.
What was the question?
I haven't read it yet. It's from Cody.
Better okay. Get your asses ready.
I'm prepared.
Don't be numb.
I'm prepared, Cody. Cody's very excited, though.
He is.
Because this month is May! That was just for Cody.
I thought he was going to do it again.
May! Jean-Claude Van Damme style.
Somebody punches that guy in Bloodsport. Oh, God.
Oh, shit, my head hurts.
Let's go before he does it again, quick.
I'm trying, I'm yawning though.
Of the dead.
Okay. He says, "Happy Friday the 13th, guys."
That's Friday the 13th, 2 weeks ago.
Well, he wrote this a couple weeks ago.
I'm sorry, Colin.
I've been busy with that series myself, reviewing them on my blog.
Cody's ain't going to the message board to get the website. I don't remember it.
Excited about the Tom McLaughlin interview since. Jason Lives is my favorite out of all of them. Anyway, since it's May of the Dead. Thank you. I figured I'd ask a question about George Romero. Now, I love most of his movies, and so do you guys, but I think he's a snob when it comes to zombie movies that aren't directed by him. As you guys said, he couldn't think of any that he liked that weren't done by him, especially Return of the Living Dead. He's also the one that supports that dumb argument for why zombies shouldn't run, which I think is shit.
Huh.
Do you guys agree with me that even though he's a nice guy, he has a major chip on his shoulder about zombie movies not made by him?
I just wanted to let Cody know, though. You know what my favorite George Romero zombie movie is?
No, what's that?
Day!
Of the Dead?
Yeah. That's it. But, yeah, I think when we interviewed Romero, Like, the question was asked, or we tried to ask it at least, what his favorite zombie movie was that wasn't his, because I never heard him ask that. He couldn't answer it. He wouldn't answer it.
Mm-mm.
And I mentioned Return of the Living Dead, and it's almost like I kicked him in the balls when I mentioned
that. Oh, shit.
I thought he would have said Shaun of the Dead, though, because that seems to be one that he supported.
I think that's one of the only ones I can think of he did support, actually. And it was much more of a comedy, anyway, than it was a horror film. But he didn't like any of the Italian movies, from what I remember, and he didn't really like any of the Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah, I think that Shaun of the Dead was a little bit more than a zombie movie, because you can see like how the guy kind of grew up a little bit through the movie. That's what I liked about it. I like that movie.
I do think, though, that he does have a block to other serious zombie movies in some way or another.
He says, one other thing, you guys have mentioned how Joe Dante clearly didn't enjoy being interviewed by you.
I didn't enjoy interviewing him.
What would you say about that interview anyway?
Yeah, we didn't, I thought it was a shitty interview and we...
It was one of the first people we ever interviewed though.
Yeah, but it was one of those deals where he was just saying what he says in every damn interview.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to give us anything.
What was the rest of the question, though? He just...
I think he just kind of goes on. He says, something similar happened when he hosted and narrated a documentary about the Bride of Frankenstein that you can see on the Universal Frankenstein Legacy series.
Hells yeah.
He clearly didn't want to be doing it and was completely uninterested.
Hmm.
I didn't understand what his deal is, because in most interviews he seems energetic and talkative. I guess everyone can have a bad day, though. Take care.
That's true. Everybody can have a bad day.
Unfortunately, you better not have a bad day on our show.
Yeah.
Because then we'll remember it for the rest of
the year. That's the thing, yeah. Well, you fuck us over, you're fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Atkins didn't realize what the hell he was doing. He looked me like a douchebag.
But, yeah. That's the thing you always hear about people. They have good experiences with these people. That doesn't matter. If we have a bad experience with them,
yeah.
We're the only ones that really matter.
You know, and sometimes we talk about pieces of shit like Andrew Bernarski or something like that. We risk to get our ass whipped, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Tom Atkins' case, that's not possible. So that's even better.
What the fuck? Yeah, he ain't gonna do nothing.
Yeah, if he tried anything with me, I'd kick the fucking dust out of his ass.
I don't know why that was so fucking funny.
You're fucking cracking up, Jet's like.
He kicked the dust out of his ass.
I would.
Oh, God. I can't breathe.
Oh. You're crying. There's
a bunch of fucking fossilized spiders and shit up in his ass, too. Here's the thing. Hey, way I look at it, a lot of people like, hey, and I'll be honest, Crater treats all these celebrities like they really are celebrities. These motherfuckers aren't celebrities, folks. I hate to break it to you. Fucking, seriously, Tom Atkins' biggest claim to fame is fucking being a racist heel on MASH back in 1975. As far as mainstream shit goes. Like, he's not a celebrity.
Ooh.
So I have no problem talking about these pieces of shit. Or kicking the fucking fossilized spiders out of their ass. I fuck you.
God almighty. Yeah. Yeah, Tom Atkins was a bit of a douche. Yeah. Which is kind of sad because he was very nice to us and he turned around and was like a big douche.
I'm going to go up to him next time and be like, hey, you're a dick.
Be like, one out of two times, Tom Atkins, you're an asshole.
Oh, I keep smelling garlic.
Oh, don't start. What's the rest of the question, though?
That was it.
Lost consciousness there for a minute.
That was
talking
it.
Talking about garlic.
I smell garlic and shit.
It does smell garlic and
all the time.
What is this? Whose name is this? Stop that!
Jonian?
Jonian?
Jonian.
Jonian?
Jonian? Stop it! Damn it! Jonian says, last week you had a question about piracy. I pretty much agree with this quote from adult blogger. Sam Sugar says, people who steal content are those who don't have any money, like kids, and those who don't think a product's worth paying for. In both cases, stopping piracy, even if possible, wouldn't result in any sales gain. The poor can't buy. The indifferent refuse to. And he says, where I live, gas is selling for $4.29 a gallon. He lives in California. My electric bill last month was $238. I don't have central heat or hair. Air.
You have central heat or air or hair.
Hair. He doesn't have central heat or hair. And every bulb in my house is fluorescent. I know people who have bills near $500. It's fucking outrageous. And he says he doesn't even have cable. I'm not condoning... Was that, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not condoning piracy, but I can understand why it's happening. He says, me, I really can't. I'm on dial-up. I'm much...
Golly, I didn't know it still exists.
I much prefer physical copies, a real DVD to own. not something that's a concept.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm patient. I can usually find what I want on sale or on eBay or on Amazon. As for your comments on downloading MP3s, easy, back up your hard drive or burn it on a CD and put it in a safe place. Problem solved. He says, CK.
That's annoying.
He says, CK, a lot of music out there now is digital only. It's cheaper for independent artists to sell their work that way.
I'm not talking about independent artists.
I still buy CDs, mostly stuff that's less than $10. Granted, there are titles out there that I want now, and I'm willing to pay the street price.
Yeah.
Anyhow, you shouldn't just discard MP3 downloads. You're missing out on some good music.
No, I'm not. okay, prepare to get schooled.
Oh, here we go. Oh, shit.
All right.
Hold on to your britches.
You walk into a restaurant. You order... Say you're walking in McDonald's, okay, and say I want a number 6 value meal, okay.
Number 6, that's what, chicken nuggets.
I think it's a fish fillet value meal. I don't know, maybe. Regardless, okay. It's $5.29. Used to say, no, I'm poor, I can't afford that. I'm just gonna go ahead and fucking take it. It doesn't work like that, does it, folks? Say you're going, you're talking about gas prices. You go to a gas station. You can't even pump the goddamn gas without putting your credit card in there. Okay? So what gives people the right to steal, you're stealing fucking movies when you, you know, burn a DVD or download a DVD. It's the same, to me it's the same goddamn thing.
I forgot last week, did we agree with piracy or not agree with it?
I don't remember either. What the hell, where does this even come from?
I don't know. Last week or something,
I'm kind of indifferent to it. Like, I don't really give a shit. If
I
it's
really
something
don't
that
care.
I want to
I don't
see.
Like people bitching about it, though, like saying they have a right to it just because they wouldn't buy it anyway.
Here's the thing. I'm not going to download shit off the internet because I'm just too lazy to do it and it takes up too much hard drive and shit. But if somebody were to send me a pirated DVD or something, I'd be like, yeah, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. I'll watch it, too.
I'll download some songs off of iTunes that
the concept is not just about piracy though. To me, it's so for some reason these people just because they can't afford it deserve free shit.
So this hits a little deeper.
It just doesn't work like that. You can't go in Walmart and take shit and just say I'm poor, I can't afford it. I'm just going to take it.
I had some people steal from me. I had a garage sale a long time ago.
They steal some of you peanuts, anal beads.
Yep.
Peanuts ain't a beast.
Oh, that China Baldwin's got a big turd on his head.
I don't care about piracy. I really don't.
I really don't care.
Either. I don't really want to take a stance on something I don't give two
shits about. I ain't
going
to take a stance on it, but I'm saying it's the same fucking thing, though. Don't you agree? Like, you can't go somewhere and be like, I'm just poor. I can't afford it. I'm going to take it. Or even though people do that.
Well, the thing is, this guy's bitching about, you know, gas prices and electric bills and him having dial-up and MP3s and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, gas is expensive around here, too. And we have, only the two of us, we have pretty high heating bills. And but, you know, it's like, I don't really bitch about it that much.
Really, though, look.
Like, we just got cable.
The only two things you can get
for
free.
I'd give up heat for cable.
The only two things you can get for free.
You don't need heat now.
Anyway, like, or that is air. Fucking music and movies. Like, you can't pirate anything. You can't pirate a bottle of fucking shampoo or anything. Like, you can, that's the only two things you can get really for free off the internet. So, I mean.
You can go to a hotel and you can steal all the little bottles of shampoo and then you'll have free shampoo for a while. Oh. Alright, that made me down. Ben says, is your Big Lots as dead as mine for DVDs? Said there hasn't been anything worth a damn for a year.
Ignore me.
Hmm?
Huh?
It just sounded funny how she said that.
What'd I say?
Anything worth a damn for years.
Oh. The glory days of walking out with about 30 DVDs in one trip is over.
It looked like to me, and we were talking about this when we were in Big Lots. It looks like Big Lots is just trying to get rid of all their DVDs and not have them anymore.
They don't ever have anything new anymore, which is like, they had like a $2 for $5 sale on the rest of their DVDs trying to get rid of them. I think they must be phasing that out now or something.
They have cooler WWE Legends figures and they have DVDs now.
That used to be an awesome place, though, to get, like, old, you know, kind of generic
nothing
DVD.
Like that. Have you ever noticed, though, nothing like that ever really lasts?
Yeah.
Like, Walmart was the same way for a while. They'd get some amazing, like, 488 DVDs, like, horror stuff.
What I'm most upset about is the fact that Big Lots had these really cool little sesame sticks that tasted really good, and I can't find them.
Oh, no.
That makes me upset.
Damn it.
Fucking sesame seed sticks.
They're really good. I can't find them. Makes me sad.
That makes me sad, too.
I'm sorry,
Jeff. I want you to have your sesame stick.
I'm really, really sorry.
Oh, that was it.
That's all for the bag this week, boys. That wasn't that big of a bag. I'm upset. We need more questions.
Well, we laughed. We got upset. It was fun.
Yeah. And, again, the Dead Pit Facebook Universe page. God damn it. Go there.
God gave it to you.
God gave Facebook Universe to you. Gave Facebook Universe to you. Gave Facebook Universe, everyone.
What's this?
I don't know. What is it?
Why don't you stop fucking with random stuff around here?
She likes looking at the shit like,
what is this? What do you have here?
So, we're going to take a break, and then we've got DVD and Blu-ray Death.
Hell
yeah.
We're
going to review Aaron. So, we will be right back after this. I'm kicking Jess out of the studio. Get your ass out of here. You're gone.
Whatever.
You get out.
I'm going to go out and go make myself something to eat.
You can go shit in a plate and eat it.
I want something chocolate.
It's chocolate.
It's fudge.
Here on Dead Pit.
Dot.
One
com.
Step
here. Hey, Uncle Bill.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm Kip Heisen.
You know Dead Pit fans out there? Not a lot of them know about the midweek obliteration.
I thought everybody knew. It's the hottest thing going today.
You can go on Facebook. Check it out on the Dead Pit Universe page. Brand new show almost every damn week. You can hear us bullshitting.
And in a historical first, there's a new member of Dead Pit. Jess Cole.
Hey, Jess Cole.
Hi.
You like joining in on the midweek obliteration every week? You like getting obliterated by two Eastern Kentuckians, don't you?
Lay it down with your sweet sultry voice.
Obliterate all over my face.
You know, yeah, you know you have a lot of guys that masturbate your voice on a weekly basis now.
Oh, God, it's like,
She's a girl. She likes hormones. She's on dad pants. That's the perfect girl for me.
I'll just tame a little bit in my pants.
How's that make you feel? You're now like a hillbilly sexual icon.
A hillbilly sexual icon?
Yeah.
Goats and sisters.
And you can hear all about it. Hey, I ask Jessica some of the nastiest shit known to man almost every week on the Midweek Obliteration, and she answers it, and she has respect for it, don't you?
What the fuck? She has respect for this question.
Yeah,
respect.
For me, telling her about what a blumpkin he is and all that.
Oh, good Lord.
She's going to try that on Uncle Bill over there.
Nobody touching me when I'm shitting. I don't give a damn what the reason is.
Even if I go in there and be like, hey.
I'm going to get out. What are you doing?
You crazy.
Pull your neck out of the toilet. Give it to me. Oh, God.
Hear all that on the midweek.
Obliteration.
Yay.
Howdy, folks, and welcome back
to
the Dead Pit. This is that special time of the show where we do the DVD and Blu-ray review, baby. We do have a DVD this week, which is a rarity.
Yeah, but before we do that, though, I know that you've got some special announcements you'd like to make.
We both have some special announcements we need to make. Well, you all know the new Dead Pit Universe Facebook page, right?
Yeah, it was a group page, but now it's a fucking fan page, and there's all kinds of nonsense about that.
Yeah. Facebook thought it would be neat if they changed the group settings where,
they just can't join a group. You have to ask for permission. And every time any little thing's done to a group, you'll send a fucking email.
And I was like, people are going to get fucking aggravated. I mean, there's a lot of reasons we changed it, but the new one is facebook.com/deadpituniverse. And just for the Dead Pit Universe Facebook page, we have a contest that we're going to announce that's going to be starting this week. And we'll say we'll run it for, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Or something. And tell them about what we got to give away, Uncle Bill. People are going to get fucking excited as shit.
I couldn't believe this. But the good folks over at Echo Bridge Home Entertainment were nice enough to bequeath upon us 5 copies. I think it's at least 5, yeah.
Yeah.
Of Children of the Corn 3 on Blu-ray.
Urban Harvest.
Fucking Urban Harvest on Blu-ray.
It is actually it's probably my favorite, but I need to see part 2. I haven't seen part 2 for a long time. But aside from part 2, it's definitely my favorite sequel, Children of the Corn.
So you can own it on Blu-ray, but here's the deal. Here's what you got to do. You got to post some sort of picture in some way using corn.
Yeah.
In the picture.
So post your corny photo for Children of Corn 3 contest. And we've been doing we did the last contest sort of like that and got a, okay response. We need to get some more fucking people. Take a fucking, that's all you gotta do. Take a photo.
Yeah, you act like we're asking for a fucking kidney or something. All you
take a photo
take
a
picture
of a can of cream corn. God damn it, how hard is it?
And we'll send you a fucking Blu-ray.
Uncle Bill, you can take a photo of a corn cob up your butt.
Have like a corn cob with a corn cob holder stuck up my butt. Ooh.
Or pour popcorn on your dick.
Here's the thing, though. You need to post it on the new Dead Pit Universe Facebook page. That's the key to all this.
Well, I've got it set to where you can't post shit on an old Facebook Universe page.
Well, good. I don't need to post shit on there anyway.
Yeah, because that's old news. It's all about the new Dead Pit Universe page. It's facebook.com/Dead Pit Universe.
So, there you go. It's a new contest. See, you can say what you want, but we're always giving away free shit.
That reminds me, I put this out here for a reason right here. Because I found these. We have never put these on sale before. And they're very limited quantities, Uncle Bill.
Woo!
The spaghetti string, baby. Dead Pit t-shirt. Well, it's not really a t-shirt. It's you'll see a photo of it. I'll have it on the website. Spaghetti string lady shirts. I'm talking uber limited quantities here, folks. And they'll be up for probably just this 1 week, maybe a couple of weeks until we sell them. And hell, who knows? If we sell them out within the first 2 or 3 days, I might order some more. If not, that'll be it. We won't have any more.
Yeah, that's it. That's the bottom line.
So it's the, yeah, all you hot women out there that want to show you big boobies, this is a perfect way. Look at it, Uncle Bill. I mean, you look at this shirt right here. If you had a good set of titties, buddy, you could really showcase them off in this shirt.
It looks like it had big biceps on the arms over there if you had big titties coming through there.
Hell yeah.
Or so, if you want to, though. You
big-titted women can go buy it.
If you're a man and you want to just wear it around the pool or something like that and catch tan, that's fine, too. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
At all.
You know, it's like a lot of the roided-up muscle head motherfuckers like wearing these shirts that look like women's tops.
Right, because they got the Vaders in them. They want to walk around and go, look how big.
Look how big and thin my chest and arms are. Yeah. So, also, a little bit of an update. I mean, we're in the early stages. We've been talking about this a lot. Like what we would do when we put all the old archive shows back up. And we're still talking about exactly what we're going to do. But I think we've basically agreed that it's going to be like a member section or a, you know, where you'll sign up for an account and we'll give you username and password and you'll be able to archive every damn thing. And there'll even be bonus stuff that we'll put up there from time to time, keep it updated. You know what I mean?
Hell to the yes.
So we're in early stages of that. Who knows when that'll happen. Hopefully it'll be within the next few weeks.
But in the meantime, chill out. Go off.
Yeah,
people want to email us all the time.
A lot of people email us about the iTunes thing. I don't know what to say about that. I've never fucked with iTunes. I don't ever want to fuck with iTunes. If there's somebody out there that wants to help us with the iTunes thing, you know, let me know. But until then, we probably won't have the show on iTunes, it doesn't look like. I know it bothers people.
It seems to really affect. They seem to be a lot of people out there that have a real problem typing in an HTML address, or I'm sorry, an HTTP address, and clicking on a button.
I noticed one fellow on the message board was saying, I have like 29 podcasts that I listen to, you know, and it's real convenient to just plug in the, you know, the YouTube or iTunes or whatever it's called and download them directly from, I don't even know how the fuck I've never used iTunes ever. I don't know how it works, but I was thinking, you know, if he's listening to 29 podcasts or whatever, they all suck compared to Dead Pit. You could make an exception with Dead Pit, goddammit. You could go to deadpit.com and listen to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to Dead Pit from deadpit.com. It's not difficult. As a matter of fact, fuck iTunes.
God.
They're trendy bullshit. Fuck it. You know, we get people, I appreciate the fuck out of the people that go to deadpit.com and check the show out.
Honestly, I don't know anything about iTunes. I have no earthly idea how.
Well, you use iTunes at least, though.
I use iTunes. I have no idea
how it works.
How to put up anything on iTunes or do anything like that. And
I'll tell you what, the only time I ever signed up for iTunes was when I got my iPhone. And I had to. I had to create an iTunes account because you have to, like, if you want to download apps and stuff like that, you have to have an account and a password and stuff.
Right. I mean, no offense to anybody that listens through iTunes, but if you love iTunes so much and that's the only way you want to get it, then help us and help yourself and other people that use iTunes and put the shit up there.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's not going to happen. Like, we don't have time to do all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy, from what I hear, to put it up on iTunes, but I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to flat out tell you. I mean, if somebody wants to do it, help us out. I mean, that's fine. But until then, I mean, we're not going to have anything on iTunes.
So quit asking us.
It's not up to us. I don't know anything about iTunes. I couldn't do it if I wanted to.
It's like, this reminds me of back in the day when everybody was asking when Dead Pit, End of the Pit was going to come out. Like, we'd get an email about every 2 weeks about that. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah. And what pisses me off even more is like, and I appreciate everybody buying it for sure. I mean, that they're supporting us and stuff. But people like are emailing me telling me that they bought it. Like, I'm going to be the one sending it to them. It is not us.
Right.
We're not getting your money.
Unless you bought it from us at a convention, that's the only way that we're selling that.
Yeah.
Like, and those are gone. So if you bought it online, you did not buy it from us. It was not affiliated in any way with
anybody. Says, hey, I just pre-ordered or ordered Into the Pit or whatever. I appreciate you ordering it, but I mean, we didn't. That's not us. That's somebody else. I mean, if we definitely wanted to get that across there too. But there's a lot of. Like, I don't know. Kelly seems to still be, like, saying, oh, you guys need to come out and support. Seems like a lot of motherfuckers have bought that that I've seen. I mean, I don't know how many. We don't keep updated with that. We probably never will know.
No.
But seems like a lot of people have bought it. And I noticed Tiffany Shepis was actually pimping it out on her Facebook, too.
She was cool. As was Kevin Tenney. You know what's weird, though, is if you sit back and think about it, the fact that, like, Kevin Tenney and Tiffany Shepis are talking about
how killer we are.
Us. It's fucking weird. You know? It's killer. Don't get me wrong. It's just weird.
Well, I mean, I would consider both of them friends, too. How weird is that?
Yeah, that's even weirder.
Like, that, like the thing is, and there are people, and I ain't going to name names, that they meet people at conventions, and they get autographs and shit like that. And there's a lot of people that we'll talk to and say hi to, but I don't consider them friends. I would consider both of those people friends.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's some people that they meet somebody up by an ice machine.
I'm not going to lie.
He's my friend.
I stalk Tiffany Shepis.
He does, though. He really does.
I kept my eye on her the whole time at Whorehound Weekend. She didn't realize it.
He's over there.
She was had in her head the whole time. I know it feels like somebody's watching me. And a motherfucker's creepy.
DVDs and Blu-rays. Yeah, we got
DVDs and Blu-rays. And we're going to talk about the movies first, then we'll talk about the wrestling thing, so all you wrestling haters can go fuck off. First one up, though, I guess we should talk about would be the Blu-ray Death Relief, baby. Image Entertainment. Short Circuit 2, which is the sequel to the original Short Circuit, is a family movie, for sure. I mean, movies like that. I watched it again not too long ago. They don't make movies like that anymore. This movie was made in the late 80s.
They don't make movies like that. No, they sure don't.
No, they don't, but that type of movie, though, like, you know what I mean? Like, in the late 80s and early 90s, they had these family comedy movies that were all very much the same. Like, Beethoven was another one that was kind of similar. Where your bad guys were more comedic bad, you know, goofy bad guys that were,
yeah, kind of like No Holds Barred.
Yeah,
I mean,
kind of like Home Alone is another one that really did that a lot.
I'll tell you what, though, I mean, the first movie, it did have Gutenberg in it and Ally Sheedy. It had some like notable people for that time period. Anyway, it was actually like a really good overall movie. Just my perspective on it. I mean, yeah, it was a little bit hokey and a little bit like out there, but I thought it was a well-made movie overall. Mm-hmm. And it's got some like really memorable lines in it, but it gets into your brain, some of the stuff in that movie, like some of the references. Because I know there's a girl that I work with, and her name's Stephanie. And like,
Stephanie!
Every fucking time like I say her name like that, just no idea what the hell I'm talking about. Like, stuff like that just gets in your head somehow. I don't know why.
Well, I mean, the original movie does have
And here's the thing. The original movie wasn't a big hit when it came out. It was more of a hit when it came out on video and stuff. More people knew about it. But, yeah, Ally Sheedy's character is just, like, adorable, really. I mean, you know, everybody could relate to her. And I think it was one of the weirdest things because, like, the relationship between her and the damn robot. Like, that's so impossible to do, but it actually... But yeah, I mean, somehow they pulled it off. I mean, the two working together. Well, Ally Sheedy's working with a robot.
Yeah. I think Ally Sheedy should be given a lot of credit for that because, you know, there wasn't anything else going on there with that damn robot. But the second one though, the second movie.
The sequel!
It does not have the main cast like Gutenberg and Ally Sheedy.
Ally Sheedy's voice is in it.
Yeah, it does have, I forget the guy's name, but he played the Indian guy.
Ben Jabari.
Yeah.
That was his name.
And Michael McKean, who's the guy from Spinal Tap and all the other films you've seen, is like the shady business partner guy in the film as well. And this one, like you know, said a little bit earlier, takes place in New York. And I guess Johnny Five is shipped to...
I don't know if they ever really say why either. He's just shipped to him.
Yeah, he's shipped to him, and
they're going on vacation or something. He's got to watch. I don't know.
And he comes out of this huge box, and like he's in this place, and the businessman guy, the Michael McKean character, comes up with the idea to make miniature like Johnny Number Five things. And stuff
meet up, Ben is like trying to hawk these robots on the street. And that's where they meet up. I mean, Jerry, I can't remember what Michael McKean's character is, or Terry or something like that, is selling like these fake Rolexes. And right beside of him, of course, is Ben, who's trying to sell the miniatures of the robot, which he made in the original. And the Ben character in the original movie is in a decent amount of the movie. But he is definitely, like, you would be surprised that they would make a sequel with him starring in it.
Mm-hmm.
But they did with this one. And so they strike a deal with a local toy manufacturer who needs so many robots by a certain amount of time. So they luck out in that Johnny Five is shipped to them, and he can make these robots at an unbelievable rate in this warehouse that they rented and stuff.
But of course... The only problem is that he wants to get out and see the city.
Yeah.
And then they're trying to keep him like locked away, and he's wanting to get out, and finally like does break loose, and then that's when the shenanigans start.
Yeah, and there's I can't remember the guy's the actor's name, but I think his name in the movie's Oscar, who's sort of like the bad guy of the movie who pretends to be the good guy. And decides to use Johnny to, steal these priceless diamonds from this bank. And that's sort of like the main plot of the movie, I guess, if you want to, everybody's tricking Johnny Five into doing illegal activities.
As you sit here and talk about the plot of this movie, though, you begin to realize how fucking silly it is, but it's like... For some reason in the 80s, this kind of stuff worked. It really did.
Well, I mean, it's still a fun and entertaining movie, but I don't know if a lot of that may be just nostalgia or what. I mean, I think kids would still like it.
Probably,
for sure.
Because it's not really a violent movie. I mean, it's got some scenes of violence in it, but it's more cartoonish and more like family-oriented kind of movie anyway, really.
But I think the robot, the look of the robot's amazing. I mean, I never understood why they didn't really make the miniature Johnny Fives and sell them, because back in the day, they would have sold a shitload of them.
Yeah, and there were a lot of robots that looked like that back in the day, though. They made these little bitty ones like that, though, except they were mostly white, but they would, like, just kind of like walk around and say different shit.
I don't think they had any... original short circuit memorabilia or anything.
Here's my question. What happened to the real Johnny Five? Like the one that they used in the movie?
I'm sure somebody had. There's probably
because that'd be worth a damn fortune.
There's probably four or five of them, actually.
Yeah.
And I know, like, it seems like I remember looking up on the internet one time where there's, like, this club online, or I don't know what else to call it, where they custom make Johnny Fives and stuff, and then they use each other's blueprints and stuff.
Damn.
So, yeah, there's a cult following for this movie.
Like the full size,
yeah,
one like that?
Yeah, there's some people that do the full size ones, some people do the smaller miniature size ones. I don't know what the fuck you do with the full size. Where do you put it? It's huge.
I don't know.
But anyway, the thing that was so interesting about the design of Johnny Five is, and I don't know, and there's rumors that they're going to remake Short Circuit or whatever. The design of it's ingenious in that it did have enough facial features on it and just stuff on its head that you really did believe it was the robot talking. I mean, that's a hard thing to do. Like, I don't know if they could pull that off today, at least without CGI or something.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, but it actually had, like, eyelids and shit. It, like, yeah, opened up, and the little voice box thing that lit up red when it was, yeah, talking. They kind of matched the voice with that, which kind of made it look like it was making, yeah, words.
Did a really good job on that, and I always liked the Short Circuit movies. I mean, I always thought they were kind of, again, nostalgic, but, I mean, I think that they're pretty good movies. Definitely, I don't think the second one's in league with the first one, but it's still, like, I could watch either one of them.
Yeah, the second one's still a good movie. I mean, for a family movie that came out around that time, for a good, like, it is kind of, I won't say it's as cheesy as a movie like Ernest Goes to Jail or something like that, but it's kind of in that same category. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's
probably
just silliness.
Probably had a little bit bigger of a budget than Ernest Goes to Jail, but.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. Which, yeah, by the way, I did watch those movies again recently. Those movies are fucking, they're awesome still, but they're corny as hell.
Well, I always thought that well, don't want to get on the Ernest, yeah, kick, but I mean the Ernest Goes to Camp was the only one that was actually like something that you could see in a theater. Like some reason, it amazes me that Ernest Goes to Jail was in a fucking theater.
It does, especially when you go back and watch it too. Because you can tell that there was no budget on that movie.
Yeah, so.
But Short Circuit 2 probably had like 1,000 times bigger budget than Ernest Goes to Jail.
But Short Circuit 2, from what I understand, was still direct-to-video release when it came out. So, but the Blu-ray, I didn't expect a lot from the Blu-ray of this, to be honest with you. Because, again, like it is, even if it was in theaters, it wasn't in theaters very long. I didn't expect them to go back and remaster a whole lot of the Blu-ray. I mean, it looks fine. But, I mean, I didn't think it was anything, you know. Oh, that's a killer Blu-ray. You would think it was a DVD. I want to be honest with you.
By the way, though, why the hell would you need a Blu-ray of Short Circuit 2?
Well, Image Entertainment thinks you do.
I mean, really. That's the thing I think about. It's like, okay, so it looks about the same as a DVD. So fucking what? Like anybody was running that. God damn it. Why ain't that out yet?
Yeah. And we have a Blu-ray contest for Children of the Corn 3.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, there's so many of these titles that are coming out that you're like, the format shouldn't be about releasing titles like that on Blu-ray, but, you know, I mean, slowly but surely the DVDs are getting phased out. I mean, let's face it, I think everything, we may even see Luck of the Necrophagus on Blu-ray at some point.
Jesus, I hope not.
Oh, look, you can see the little static on the end of the tape over there. Cool.
There are some Blu-rays where I just, when I see them, I'm like, why in the hell would I want that on Blu-ray? Because it just, like, dramas and stuff really don't benefit that much from being on Blu-ray.
Yeah, but like I was saying, everything is going to Blu-ray. So that's why, I mean, the format.
Well, obviously, if Short Circuit 2, it's going to be on Blu-ray, everything.
Well, Short Circuit 2, the Children of Corn sequels, the Hellraiser sequels, the Ernest movies.
Yeah, that's sad.
Asylum's releasing shit on Blu-ray. So, anyway, a horse of a completely different color here. This is Darren Aronofsky. And as far as I know, I don't think the Short Circuit 2 Blu-ray has any special features on it. I have a theatrical trailer.
I think it does,
like,
but nothing else.
But it's a cheap enough Blu-ray. I mean, you know, if you want to get the movie, to me, if I had to make a choice, of regardless of whatever it was, to buy a DVD or a Blu-ray, I'd still buy the fucking Blu-ray. As long as it wasn't like $50 or $30, whatever. So anyway, the Blu-ray death of Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, Uncle Bill.
Oh my lord. See, I think we all had mixed reactions when we first saw this movie, though, and we saw it all together. The thing, I don't think that neither you or I actually liked it as much as Jess did, but...
Jess isn't here to comment.
Yeah, it is an interesting movie, to say the least, so we'll take you through like a little bit of it, the plot-wise right now, though. Natalie Portman, of course, is the star of the film, and she is a ballerina, and she... They're getting ready to do a ballet of Swan Lake, and they need somebody to play the black swan and the white swan, I guess, which are like two different sides of personality. Like, one is the good side, the other is...
Well, they need one person to play both characters, though, right?
Right. No, that's what I said. It's two different sides of the same personality. Like, one is the dark side, one is the good side. And so Natalie Portman gets picked to play the role, and she's already like, that's the thing I noticed about this movie, is like all the way through the movie you're just nervous as hell because you can tell that something's wrong with her to begin with anyway. And then she gets this role and she's living with her over domineering mother who used to be like a ballet star but never really made anything of herself. And then so she's got added pressure on herself to perform because of that. And all the pressure from all the other people in the cast of the film too. And as the film progresses, you start to notice she's got these weird physical symptoms that start happening to her. Like she gets these scratches on her back and she gets all these, she starts having these kind of hallucinating experiences and all this stuff, hallucinations and delusions. And so it just gets weirder and weirder as the film goes on. And as all this is going on, she's also developing a relationship with another one of the dancers who's played by, is it Mila Kunis?
Yeah.
Woo, baby. Mm.
Who I guess is like her understudy in case something were to happen to her for like the Black Swan part. This would be the woman that would take over, like the ballet star would take over.
There's a lot of ballet in this movie, too. We don't want to like say, oh, it's just about... a dancer and her going crazy. It is, but it features a shitload of ballet.
It's very ballet heavy.
Yeah.
But it is actually like a giant metaphor for life, really. I mean, the ballet is kind of just secondary to the story that's being told underneath.
Yeah, but the ballet takes up the majority of the movie. Let's
but
be
yeah,
honest.
The actual ballet is a huge part of the movie.
You know, and I'm not a huge fan of the movie, but I'll say this. I think this was the best acting performance that Natalie Portman I've ever seen her in, at least. I thought that she did a great job.
I thought she was a lot better in Attack of the Clones, though. That was,
oh, did you?
Yeah, that was where I thought she shined.
And the movie, it does, like, in a lot of Darren Aronofsky movies, too, like, visually or just, you know, off camera, they go where usually you don't see movies go, like, with violence or just, you know, something that tells you it's not a mainstream movie. And they do that in this movie in a couple of ways. I don't want to say what, but I mean, in past movies like he did Requiem for a Dream, the double dong dildo scene, let's rock it, Uncle Bill. It was awesome. And, you know, the scenes in The Wrestler that he did with the Necro Butcher and,
yeah,
you know, with the staple gun and all that shit. You know, it's taking it far, and they do it in this movie too.
There's a ton of stuff in this movie though where you don't really know what the hell's really going on. Like, yeah. It's a mindfuckish kind of movie where you don't know if there's certain things going on in her head or if they're really going on or if she is the. It's just several different sequences where you, and I think Aronofsky purposely tries to confuse you with a lot of the shots that he...
Well, they definitely plant the seed, though, that this girl is not all there.
Yeah.
You know, with her mother, you see her early on, her mother tucking her into bed. Her bedroom looks like a bedroom of, like, an eight-year-old girl. You know, she asks her mother for warm milk or something like that, you know, like a little kid. So you know that she's not all there, or her mother is really, you know... Maybe it's just where her mother has pampered her and pampered her like a little baby. You know, maybe that's what it is.
So you don't really know fully until towards the end, and then it get the end of the movie is really fucking strange and very much in the vein of like a Dario Argento movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really did seem like a European style thriller giallo movie though. It's like a psychosexual like something. I don't know how it's hard to explain what type of movie it is, but I do know that like throughout the film you are like really riveted to the screen. Like, you don't know what's... I think that's the thing that Aronofsky does so well in this movie is he's got you so off kilter and so confused that you don't really know what to expect. And that's when, like, that's the hallmark of a movie that you want to follow is you don't know where the director's going to go or what he's going to do or what the end game of the movie is or anything like that until the end of the movie. So you constantly want to try to figure out what the fuck is going on throughout, like, the entire movie, because it seems like a dream.
Yeah.
Like almost like an Argento, like you said, like he would make those movies where it was just so surreal and you didn't know what was going on.
And I think that this may be one of those movies that, because I gotta admit, I mean, the second time I watched it, I think I liked it a little bit more, and maybe like over the next few years, I mean, we may learn to appreciate it more. But it just, I don't know, it was just the whole setting, I guess, is the thing. Like, I'm
plus,
not into that.
It's like a character study.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a whole lot else going on except watching Natalie Portman go fucking nuts, basically.
Yeah. And I think it's a movie that almost anybody would like, at least for the first time. I mean, you want to watch it at least once. And, it's just, I think everybody should see it at least once. I'll say that.
Yeah, I agree too. And there's a big uproar about this film, though. I keep hearing stuff about it where Natalie Portman, of course, an actual world-class ballerina that did the stunt work in the film for her. And this is a similar situation that you heard with Flashdance back in the day where there was a woman that said she did all the dance sequences for Jennifer Beale. Well, this woman claims that she did all the ballerina sequences and they CG'd Natalie Portman's face onto her body in some sequences. And, well, actually, on the majority of the actual end sequence, like where the big show is and stuff, and said that she should have gotten credit. I don't think she got any kind of credit for, like, that.
She didn't get any credit on the movie?
I don't think she did, or if she did, she didn't get the credit.
Well, like, I mean, she should get credit on the damn movie. I thought she was wanting, like, some sort of recognition for the award or something.
Maybe that is part of it, too. I don't know. But, I mean, I don't know how much of that is Natalie Portman and how much of that is that girl, but it seems to me it would be very hard to learn to dance that way that quickly.
Yeah, because they have a lot of shots, too, like, and I've always been curious about this because, I mean, you know that ballerinas or whatever, that their feet are fucked up. They have to be, I mean, if you do it very long because you're on your feet so much anyway, and then, like, the little twists and shit that they do, they have to be on their damn toes and... And they do go into that a little bit. I mean, they show, like, her feet look all jacked up and shit, and they do a lot of stuff to their shoes to help. I don't know. I always thought that was interesting. And Aronofsky, that's the thing. He does that in his movies, and he captures realism quite a bit.
Yeah.
In, like, anything that he does.
Well, the real way, or the way that I've noticed it works to capture realism, is you show the things that are just the mundane, everyday type of things that people go through that not a lot of other filmmakers will concentrate on, just like the basic stuff that doesn't seem very glorious or anything, but that really makes up a large part of the day. Yeah. And I would say that fucking with your feet and like taping yourself down is a huge part of a ballerina's day.
Taping your toes and
yeah.
And you know, Darren Aronofsky, his stuff's always good. I mean, that's the thing. If you see a movie that's out from him and he takes his time, he releases what, one movie every 3 or 4 years, it seems like, you're almost guaranteed the movie's going to be really fucking good, regardless if it's, like, nominated for Academy Awards or whatever else. I mean, I think, you know, having Natalie Portman in it helped him quite a bit in the Academy Award thing this time around. To be honest with you, I think that Mickey Rourke deserved to win the fucking Academy Award a couple of years ago. I think that was the year... Sean Penn wins shit every fucking year.
Yeah.
But does. I think he won that award. To me, that was bullshit too, but whatever.
But at the end of this movie, the question that I really had that I think that he was trying to trying to get you to ask was, is like, at what cost will people go for to be perfect or to be, you know, noticeable and things like that? Like, to achieve your goals, like, what is it worth to you? And you find out when you watch this movie.
And you gotta have the power and you gotta have the glory.
That's right. But, okay, this is...
The Blu-ray Death, baby.
Yeah, the Blu-ray's from 20th Century Fox, and it includes extras including Metamorphosis, a behind-the-scenes documentary with Darren Aronofsky, Behind the Curtain, an inside look into a ballet's influence on the film's costume and production design, 10 years in the Making with Natalie Portman and Aronofsky discussing their journey for the creative parts of the roles and all that, cast profiles, and it does have, like, a special... digital copy as well, although I have no interest in that, but you might, so I don't know.
No, not really.
I was just talking, I was talking to them. Like,
that's
they
the
might.
iTunes people would be interested in that.
Yeah.
So, put on your fucking iTunes shit.
Now let's talk about the quality of the Blu-ray though, because I think this is where we differ a little bit. I was really disappointed in the quality of the Blu-ray. I thought that for a movie that won an Academy Award and was that hyped up, this should have been like the fucking stellar Blu-ray release of the year.
Well, the thing is, though, Black Swan was an independent movie, though. I mean, Aronofsky stuff, who distributed it anyway?
20th Century Fox.
20th Century Fox. But it was done through the Fox Searchlight shit, you know, the smaller division of Fox. The Wrestler didn't look that great on Blu-ray. I mean, it's not going to look as good as, like, your big budget, you know, Fast and Furious.
I mean, when you heard this movie was coming out on Blu-ray, though, you had to be excited just because...
I thought it looked okay, though. I mean, I didn't think, I mean, it had grain and stuff on it, but I mean, I didn't think it was a bad, I thought it was way better than The Wrestler was, actually.
This movie, I mean, to me, was made for Blu-ray, just because of all the costumes and the set design and what it was about and everything. I just thought it looked way too plain and like, almost like, in certain sequences, like DVD quality.
Well, like I was saying, I mean, it's not, he doesn't use the same, it probably doesn't use the same equipment that the big budget movies use. So, I mean, that's probably why it doesn't look, you know, pristine like newer movies normally look. But, I mean, I didn't think it looked that bad, to be honest with you. I thought it looked pretty good. I mean, for what it was, and a lot of people say if it's a bad transfer, it's got a lot of grain on it. I mean, that's not necessarily true. Like a newer movie like this, yeah, I can understand, like, people complain about grain because it's a new movie. But, like, to me, grain makes it look like it's a fucking movie. You know, if you watch a movie in the theater, you're going to fucking see grain.
Especially if you watch it in Paintsville. That theater sucks. That's beside the point, I guess.
The theater smells like ass.
This conversation. Anyway, I was not... it didn't pop and lock to me, but...
I say it looked all right.
We'll differ on that one.
So you have to be your own judge, I guess.
So... Up next, though, I guess this is the wrestling portion of the
yeah.
Movie, so you can
all
tune
you
non-wrestling
fans can get out of here. Bye. We'll see you next week. We don't know what we're doing next week. It is the final week of.
Of the dead.
Next week.
Yeah, that's it next is. Week.
But yeah, this is a lot. This is receiving a lot of. Press online on wrestling sites and stuff. And, I never thought, when I heard about this and I heard who was in it, what's the big fucking deal? You know, it's kind of a documentary and I put it in for like, I was like, it was one of those deals where I was like, I'll put it in for 10 minutes and check it out. And I was like, oh my God. And it's almost 3 hours long and it fucking flew by. You know, just because it's so interesting how these guys, it's basically the story of these independent wrestlers, which I know two of them were actually, or one of them is actually still in WWE. The other one was briefly in WWE and the other one's like a rookie, I think. And, they're all friends and they're all traveling around the East Coast. On their schedules for wrestling, independent wrestling and stuff. And it's these guys filming it. There's not a film crew or anything.
Yeah.
It's just basically follows them for like, I think they say it's the last week of Bryan Danielson's, independent, you know, before he goes to WWE. That was the whole idea of it. And it shows a couple of the it doesn't show the full matches, I don't think. It shows a couple snippets here and there of some of their matches and stuff. But it's basically them, you know, going from town to town, place to place, telling stories and, you know, going to various wrestling events, showing up, signing autographs. Just basically a week in the life of these guys as independent wrestlers.
Immediately, like after I watched this, the thing that I thought was that it was like the anti-Beyond the Mat. Because all these guys are actually good friends. None of them do anything. There's no drug use. There's no alcohol use. There's nothing like that going on. So, like, right away, it's completely different than anything you would see, like, the darker side of wrestling type of documentaries and all that shit. It's actually, like, the side of wrestling that doesn't really get any attention, which is the side where you got, like, a group of guys that really genuinely like each other and are trying to pursue their dreams and who don't do any of that stuff, but are just, like, goofy sons of bitches that are on the road with each other, you know. And there's a real friendship between the guy that's like Colt Cabana and the guy that, you know,
Sal Renaro.
Yeah. And then, of course, Brian Danielson, too. It's really just like the fun parts of being on the road and wrestling. There's none of the other stuff in there, really.
Well, you always hear, like, if you have any of the shoot interviews and stuff, you hear about them. Oh, we'll just find... you know, we find wherever to sleep. We don't stay at home. And they show you that. Like, they find all some guy they meet at this independent show. It's like, oh, yeah, I got to let y'all can sleep in the living room. And they fucking lay on the floor in the living room and go to sleep, you know. And it really, like, the thing is, and it sucks because you don't get this in WWE. It's like you really get to know these guys.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, there's parts in that are very, like, heartfelt that you don't get to see any of these documentaries either. Like, where Brian Danielson goes and sees his sister, and they go and stay at her house, and they're, like, shooting guns, and she's got, like, a big farm and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Just, like, little things like that, they never show you that kind of shit. Like, they always have people talking about these people in the WWE ones, but they never actually show you their behind-the-scenes lives and stuff like that.
Yeah, and like WWE, and you talk about WWE films and shit like that, they should do something like this.
They'll never do anything like that, I guarantee it.
Like, how fucking cool would that be, though? Like, give the guys a little... Who get the shit? They made fucking Knucklehead. God damn it. They could fucking... they could come up with something. Just the jobber guys, I mean. Because, like, I've heard... I've never seen hardly any of his matches, but, Dave Meltzer always says that Colt Cabana is like the best wrestler that doesn't have a job, like in TNA or WWE out there.
He was with, and you find out in this, he was with WWE for a while and then got fired, I guess.
I didn't even know he was with him, but I remember I think he was on SmackDown or something. I think the other guy's just really like a rookie kind of, or hasn't really been doing it that long. But the documentary is 2 hours and 40 minutes. And, it was only later, edited. And, cause they didn't really know, there's a long story about how this got started. Like, it was originally going to be, Colt Cabana's last week before he went to WWE, and something happened where, like, I think Brian Danielson was in Japan, or they couldn't all get together and do it. And interestingly enough, like, the documentary is, like I said, the week before Danielson goes to WWE, and it's an interesting take, too, because Colt Cabana, what did he say his name was? Scotty something in WWE.
In WWE? I don't remember now.
Or he had already been there, and he was back doing the independents.
Which is, honestly, really I think that's circle. where Daniel Bryan is headed. Because they transferred him to SmackDown, and it's only like a matter of time before they fire his ass off SmackDown, I guarantee it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he'll probably always have a job there because they're scared what he would do if he was somewhere else.
But regardless, though, this... this movie is 1,000 times better than any, like, of the WWE stuff that I've seen, really. Just because of how in-depth that it is, mm-hmm. with all the guys in it and stuff. Like, there's stuff in here that you would never, ever get to see through one of the WWE documentary releases or anything like that. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. And when you, it's long as hell, though. Yeah. It's like friggin', is it like 2.5, 3 hours
yeah,
long?
Yeah, it's almost 3 hours.
And most of it is like them going from town to town to these different independent wrestling shows and just setting up and wrestling and what happens in between that and things like that, too. But, I mean, it is to the point where you're like, golly, I mean, this is good and everything, but it should end at some point.
I don't know. I did enjoy it all the way through. And if you're a wrestling fan, it is. I watch a lot of wrestling stuff, like shoot interviews and stuff like that. I think we'll see more stuff like this. I mean, down the line, they did a really good job with this. Great camera work and stuff like that. Even though it was, I guess they gave him a HD camera or something or whatever they did, and let him film whatever. But yeah, I think you can get this on like highspots.com, and there's a couple other websites that have it.
I'm just glad they took a balanced approach to this. Like, if you're going to release all the other stuff that just details, like, the people that are fucked up and have drug issues and family issues and all that shit, then you should at least show something where the people are really positive about where they're going and are okay with it. Even, like, Cabana in this, there's no real sense of, like, bitterness about him.
No.
Getting, like, leaving WWE.
And they all seem like really nice guys, too, yeah. is the thing. I mean, and they're not fake. You can tell. Because sometimes you can tell in some of this, like, the WWE-produced stuff, and all this is just a fucking script, every bit of it. And this one is, like, totally, like, just on the road, you know, bullshitting. And actually, I think Colt Cabana and a comedian. Did you see the link that I put of, it's called $5 Wrestling?
Hmm.
I'm thinking about getting some of those DVDs where they're commenting on some of the shittiest, like, independent wrestling.
It's a good idea.
Like Mystery Science Theater style, where their silhouettes are up there and they're fucking making fun of people. And
yeah.
I've got it on my Facebook page if you want to check it out. But he's doing a lot of stuff with, you know, DVD entertainment-related stuff like that. And who knows? I mean, I'm sure the guy will probably get another shot in one of the two Impact Wrestling or whatever they call it in WWE. But, yeah, wrestling fans should definitely check out the Wrestling Road Diaries. I enjoyed it.
Check it out.
This one comes with the bonus disc, but I didn't check out the bonus disc.
I didn't either, because once you watch 3 hours, you just, I think I've seen enough.
I think it's just more scenes from, you know, they didn't use in the main documentary. But,
yeah, for wrestling fans and just fans of documentaries, though, you should probably check that out.
Yeah. So, that is it for this week. I'd like to thank for sure Stuart Gordon for taking the time out to do the interview and, Jess Cole for the mailbag portion. I'm sure it'll be killer.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll let you know what we're going to do next week. I mean, there's a couple things we could do. Uncle Bill will have to. We'll have to discuss them. But, like I said, we got the new, Dead Pit Facebook page, facebook.com/deadpituniverse. You can win Blu-ray disc of Children of the Corn 3, baby. Woo!
All you gotta do is take a big deal with a big old piece of corn in some way, or some kind of corn reference.
Yeah, get your buck tooth mama to fucking gnaw from corn.
Oh.
And you can win Blu-rays.
But you know we'll figure something out for the last show.
We will.
I doubt seriously unless the interview drops in our lap.
It'll probably suck.
It might, but.
But hell, how can you top Stuart Gordon?
It's free.
Seriously.
You know?
It is. Right now it is.
We've had 3 interviews in the last 3 weeks, so you can blow me if you don't like it.
So anyway, we will be back next week for the finale of May.
Of the dead.
Here on Dead Pit.
Don't talk to strangers, 'cause they're only there to do you harm. Don't in starlight, 'cause the words may come out real.